Good morning, everyone. Coming to you live from somewhere in the Middle East, it is Saturday morning's hottest streaming media political talk show, Inside the Eye, live with The Fedge. Did I just hear someone tell a standing member of Congress that if it were up to them, they would dump the Israelis tomorrow? Sounds like something you might hear right here on Inside the Eye Live.
The Fetch. What a man. Oh, my God. You have to listen to that show. He was brilliant. I didn't know he had gonads of steel like that and a mind like a frigging razor. I didn't realize he was so clear. He cut through this that cognitive dissonance that is going on in the whole Patriot music movement.
And now it's time for Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. From Amman, Jordan, this is The Fetch, and you are live Inside the Eye. Today's date is Saturday, August the 11th, 2018, and a good Saturday morning to all of you listening in the United States and Canada, and a good late afternoon to early evening to all of you listening in the United in European and Asian time zones. And of course, wherever you are listening out there on the World Wide Web or our FM and micro FM broadcasting outlets, may all be well with you and yours. The weather here in Amman has yet to make it into the 90s, believe it or not, as we hit a high of only 89 degrees today, while winds have been a variable 11 miles per hour coming out of the west. But for the most part, it feels as if the breeze has been kind of subdued today. I'm looking out my window now, and there's basically no breeze whatsoever to speak of. That does make it feel a little bit hotter than normal, but I guess if we had a breeze, it would be a little bit fresher. But when that breeze does kick up, obviously, it's very, very nice. So we are expecting temperatures, though, to fall pretty quickly as the sun settles, and we're going to be hitting something like 75 degrees somewhere around 9 o'clock, and continuing on down until it reaches a low of 67 degrees in the hour before sunrise. Now, we again are expecting somewhat of a heating trend, but so far we're not getting up into the 90s, man. So this is by far the most pleasant summer I've ever experienced in Amman. Not ever, but it's one of the most pleasant I've experienced here in Amman in quite some time. I know last summer, previous summer was kind of hot, but this week has been very comfortable, and it's very comfortable last week and the week before, and we're expected to be reasonably comfortable going into next week. So wherever you are, we hope your summer's going okay. I understand it's a little bit warm in some areas out there, but nonetheless, guys, that's the way it works sometimes. Chat room is open, InsideTheEyeLive.com. That's InsideTheEyeLive.com. You can click on the live chat button. That will get you in the door there. Telephone lines are going to be open early, 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. We theoretically, it looks like we are streaming on YouTube. That's right. The live stream at YouTube is going. That would be youtube.com. User Inside the Eye Live. Just do a search Inside the Eye Live. Google usually will serve you pretty quickly to that web page, or do that through YouTube search engine. You'll be able to pick it up pretty quick. But we do have the live stream going now. I'm not there yet. I haven't even seen the stream yet, but it's going. And last one is our guests. That's right. We've got a couple guests, great guests lined up today. In the second hour, we're going to have Jack Sen. Jack Sen, if you recall, was here maybe 2 months ago, month and a half ago, something like that. He's the author of the best-selling book, How to Get Suspended from the British BNP and UKIP in 10 articles and 2 tweets. And he was a UKIP prospective member of parliament for Northern England before being unceremoniously and quite publicly suspended by his party 1 week prior to the elections over, oh, that dogged term, anti-Semitism. That's right. If you're don't worshiping Jews out there, you can't run for public But Mr. Sen's quite active in writing. His articles have appeared in the BBC, ITV, The Independent, and Channel 4 News, Breitbart, The Guardian, among many others. And in hour number three, we're going to have David Gehry. I'm not sure I'm saying that right, but Gehry. He's a veteran that served in the United States Navy aboard the USS Skate, which is an attack submarine, nuclear-powered fast attack submarine. I think that I got that out right. And he was a nuclear propulsion plant engineer there. And he has been a radio show host, talk radio show host, for quite some time after he got out of the Navy. And he's been appeared in stations in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. And he's written a book out there called Erasing the Liberty. And what is that? The Erasing the Liberty, the battle. That's it. The battle to keep alive the memory of the USS Liberty. So he's going to be here in hour number three. So look forward to that. We should have a full packed show again. So that should be quite good. And I just got to tell this person here, I'm live, so please, so hang tight. Okay, so basically, guys, that's it. Now, if you weren't listening to Thursday's show, we covered some of the internet censorship going on, especially in hour number two with Alex Jones talking about how he is being victimized and censored, and all of that is all well and good. The problem with Alex Jones is that he's been talking a lot about how it's the Chinese. We are learning more about what's going on, but what's really interesting about the internet censorship is it's been going on, folks, for really over 12, 13, 14 years. Now, what it really was, and it's often been centered around this idea of 9/11, people who talk about 9/11, people who talk about Jewish domination in our politics, these are typically the people being targeted. Now, in Alex Jones's case, that's probably not an exception here, because he often talks a lot about some of the false flag conspiracy stuff that Jewish media does not want you, the audience, to really understand, really the American people to really grasp and understand exactly what's happening in our nation today. What's interesting about Alex Jones and his banishment, his takedown from the fags, which was Facebook, Apple, Google, and Stitcher, and others, I believe. But he's still on Twitter, by the way. But one of the things about this is that if you go back, and hang tight, I'm gonna open this up here and make this a bit bigger so I can see it. It's hard to do live radio read when it's so far away. And that's too big. Okay, there. That'll help me see. Yeah, so I've been in the live TV style studios, everybody, and you're looking at the camera right there, and you got the nice teleprompter. I haven't broken down and bought one of those yet, everybody. I think we would need to raise another $400 for me to do that, to bring it in and stuff like that. I got all the other equipment, but I don't have the teleprompter. So I'm having to do this a lot, looking at two different screens here. I've got my production screen for the YouTube, and I got all these people. They know I'm live, man, but it's like, please, I can't even read this. It's too far away if I don't have. Yeah, but basically, guys, I'm live, guys. Let's try to keep the private messages down to a minimal, because it's quite distracting. Let's see. But do let me know if I'm not coming through okay. Anyways, back to the internet censorship. We just want to say, look, this has been going on for a long time. And until the evolving of the internet, you really had a controlled, centralized communication output. You had the media, which was open air, which was all licensed, although we had far more stations back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. For the most part, still, there was a lot of control over those networks. When you got into the print media, most of this by the 80s, 90s was pretty well bought up by Jewish groups, going all the way back into the 20s, the 30s in America. You had Henry Ford talking about how Jewish interests. Jewish groups control the media all the way back in the 1920s. So Jewish control of the media has been going on for quite some time. There seems to be some, this is just tongue in cheek, everybody, but there seems to be some obsession by Jews to tell everybody what they should and shouldn't think. I mean, why else would they be so focused on the media? No, the reality is that they are doing quite a lot of criminal activity subsurface. They are engaged in destroying the government's corruption, bringing Americans and other nations to war. And they can't do that type of destruction unless they are able to gain hold of media, which will then will influence your thinking out there. Now, if you go all the way back to 1991, we had the what we called the incubator baby story. And that was floated on all the major televisions. CNN, I think, was already operating back then as a cable network. And what it was you had some criminal, quite frankly, should be arrested. She should be thrown in jail. If you want to take the Nuremberg precedent, you should and be more than willing and free to hang this young woman. But she came up on national media and she talked about how Saddam Hussein's military was ripping all these babies out of the incubators and throwing them on the floor. And oh my God, it's so terrible. Recently, you had the stories coming out of Syria with the gas attacks, which absolutely and most 90%, 97% were done by the CIA / deep state / opposition, whatever you want to call it. And the media goes out and runs with these stories, literally slapping us in the face. This is all now what we call nowadays fake news. And they have done so much harm to the American people, so much harm to Western civilization, because they have been in control and dominated our news, and they have absolutely not allowed any type of dissent within their own platforms. Now, when we get into the social media, when we created as a nation internet protocol, I'm not talking about Facebook is a private company and Twitter is a private company. I'm talking about internet protocol, this distributed communication network system. This was all done because there was a real pressing concern that should the Jews who were running the Soviet Union at the time, should they mount some type of nuclear strike and take out some of the strategic telecommunications hubs in America, they could effectively silence the entire nation by cutting all the communications. So what internet protocol was all about was how do we distribute telecommunications in such a way that if a node goes out like Chicago, we could still route the traffic around and around until it got there, reassemble all of this information, and then be able to, again, communicate in real time. Now, that is how the internet protocol system is all about. That is a U.S. taxpayer-funded technology. All websites are working based on the internet protocol technology. Facebook didn't go out and develop some fascinating protocol that works in such a way that it's actually able to communicate in light speed around the world without going over internet protocol, which is a U.S. taxpayer developed technology. So when we look at companies like Facebook, like Google, like Stitcher, like Apple and Google and you know all these major tech companies, and we look at how they are censoring particular points of view in the political spectrum, what we have here then are extensions of political parties. Facebook is an extension of essentially Jewish political left progressive parties. The same could be said about YouTube. The same largely can be said about Google. You are talking about anti-Western, anti-white, anti-conservative, anti-libertarian. All of these companies are focusing, or not focusing, but are in the they're an extension. Let's be honest. They are an extension of Jewish power politics. period. They are a political arm, but they are being funded by we, the taxpayers, because they're working off of our technology at the end of the day. And they're getting through scot-free for the most part. I don't think that's a fair statement, quite honestly, without studying the economics. Let me be fair there. But nonetheless, folks, we have a serious problem right now with the direction upon which big tech has thrown in its lot to the anti-white, anti-conservative, anti-American, anti-Western agenda that is being foisted upon we here in the West. And it's something to be very, very you should be taking this serious. Now, when you look at an Alex Jones being banned, he's talking on and on and on about the Chinese. Well, he wasn't banned by the Chinese. He was banned by Mark Zuckerberg personally. That story came out of the New York Times just this week. Mark Zuckerberg personally banned him. Now, I'm sure the leftists and the progressives, yeah, but Mark Zuckerberg's wife is Chinese and she's the one who gave the order, so therefore it came from the Chinese. Now, I don't think it quite works that way. This is a case where Mark Zuckerberg personally made the decision under pressure with some of his Jewish people behind him, because he's obviously a Jewish guy. Now, what's interesting is if you go back to July the 18th, just a couple weeks ago, Mark Zuckerberg, he was defending his company's decision to keep on its platform InfoWars. So you have to understand, going back a month ago, there was a lot of pressure by Jewish politicians, those aligned with Israel, to take InfoWars offline. And they were not able to do so, apparently. Mark Zuckerberg, I got to do one more thing here because I cannot hear the studio. So if you guys in the studio can hear me, I could not hear the studio at all this morning. So I'm working off of the clock. So let's see. Now, Zuckerberg was interviewed, around a couple weeks ago. And he said that Facebook had a responsibility to curb the viral spread of hoaxes and blatant misinformation. Now, here's where the problem comes in. The argument you're hearing a lot of times now when it comes to this quote-unquote censorship is censoring hoaxes and fake information. Well, there's been pranks ever since I can recall. There's phone pranks. There's all kinds of pranks out there, which are hoaxes or whatever. But here's the key point. If we are going to get into a situation in America now where our social media, folks, this is, don't think it's just private anymore. Just make the imposition that it's yours and start to act like it, and then demand from your technology that they start to follow American type of thinking here and protect your rights to be heard. Now, going back, when we talk about hoaxes and blatant misinformation, where is the complete banishment of Jewish media? Think about it. This is not about hoaxes and blatant information, misinformation. If they are serious about blatant misinformation, then they should be required to have a full-time staff, and we want to see every single story that comes out of CNN, every single Jewish media outlet out there. We want it completely banned and blocked on the net. We want this to be taken to if you're going to play the censorship game, then let's start really attacking those behind the censorship, and that's Jewish groups. There should be absolutely no reason why CNN should be allowed to say anything on air unless it's 100% true. The idea, think about this, folks. The idea in America is very simple. Media companies are no longer news gathering companies. They are not. The Smith, I keep forgetting, Smith something act, I forget it. Okay, you can throw that one in the chat room. But Huxley, I think Smith's Huxley Act. When that act was taken down, this allowed all media companies to engage in what they had been engaging in anyways, basically false news. Media companies are not news gathering companies. MSNBC is, there it is. Thank you, man. I'm going to look for this one. Hold on a second. Smith Munst. I got to think of the Munsters. Okay. The Smith Munst Act. Thank you very much for that. Remember, CNN has zero responsibility to you, the public, to report anything factual. They have zero responsibility. In fact, they are openly free to propagandize anything they want. That's fake news, folks. That's misdirection. That is hoaxes. That's whatever you want. They can throw up a Sandy Hook story all night long, and there's no need for them to actually be truthful. They can throw up. I mean, come on. Who remembers the Las Vegas shooting? Anybody out there? Do you remember the Las Vegas shooting? Yeah, it's gone off the air so fast they can't bury it quick enough. Why? Because the entire story was, quote unquote, fake news. It was not. Now, we're not saying things didn't happen there. There's a difference between, let's say, the Parkland shooting, where there were, I'm sure, some crisis actors. There were things going on there that was fake. That doesn't mean nobody got hurt. That doesn't mean that, but it's what it's saying is that the news itself, think about this, the news itself is fake, period. It is fake. Now, they call it in social media circles, the Jewish people running our social media companies right now, they are saying that they want to stop the blatant misinformation. Well, that would mean that every ounce of news on this planet should be 100 and, well, you can't really go above 100% in this case, but it should be 100% certified and verified. And if the social media companies allow 1 ounce of fake news through, they should be penalized to the point that within weeks we put them out of business. Because what they are saying to all of us is if you are somebody that they don't like, they are absolutely in their rights to block you. And they don't have to give any reason. They can just call it anything, fake news, fake this, fake that. We're Jews. What? Hey, why don't we, you want to talk to us? Hey, this is our company, man. Hey, yeah, I know that we're protected by lawsuits from you, but hey, I'm Jewish, man. That's kind of the mentality of the social media companies right now. It's I'm Jewish, you're not, you're going to listen to us, and therefore, if you don't like it, we're going to ban you. And then you got the clowns, the real serious guys that reach 20 million people. It's got 3 million followers or 3 million, 3.5 million YouTube subscribers like Alex Jones. And he goes on, the Chinese, Mr. President, Mr. President, I know you're real. American people think you're real, but you got to sanction the Chinese. We ain't got to sanction the Chinese right now for nothing. Let's focus on the real problem. The real problem, they wear these funny little hats. They're called yarmulkes. They don't have their propeller, but we ought to put one on and force them to put one on because half of what they do is so stupid and silly. It's moronic. I mean, nobody asked Jews to flood our country, but they're flooding our country left, right, everywhere with all this migration. And folks, you cannot integrate as much as they're bringing in. So basically, it goes down to population replacement. Population replacement is demographics. Demographics means you lose your power. You lose your country. And if you don't think it's important, please spend some time studying Israel. These guys are the most racist, vile people out there, and they have an absolute 100% demographic-centered political process, okay? Literally a 100% demographic-centered political process. That's how they're doing this. Figure this thing out by now. I mean, seriously, figure it out. What Zuckerberg was saying, he said the approach that Facebook was taking when it came to quote-unquote fake news, and that's whatever Jews don't like. Remember, I don't like it. I call it fake news because it's all fake. It's all fake for the most part. It's for the most part when you get deep into all these agendas and it's fake. But nonetheless, he says, the approach that we've taken to false news is not to say you can't say something wrong on the internet. He said, everyone gets things wrong. And if we were taking down people's accounts when they got a few things wrong, then that would be a hard world for giving people a voice and saying that you care about that. Well, the fact of the matter is that, yeah. If you're going to take down everybody that says something wrong, you're not going to have an internet. People by nature are going to be making mistakes. Even I've made mistakes and people said, Fetch, you need to retract that one. We're not happy with that one. Please look into it a bit deeper. Now, fortunately, I don't have it happen too often, but it happens. Okay. We all make mistakes, but it's not for some Jewish social justice warrior overpaid, non-productive, leftist nutcases to be sitting there at $40,000, $45,000 a year in a cushy office in Menlo Park or wherever else they're working, deciding what's fake or not. Again, how do we turn over our political discourse, our rhetorical channels to a bunch of nutcase morons who don't have a freaking brain cell in their head? How are we going to do that, folks? It absolutely makes no sense. It's the Fetch going into a break. Back with more right after this. Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware. All right, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Fetch. Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware right here on Revolution Radio at revolution.radio. I almost get confused when I say that there. Yeah, Revolution Radio at revolution.radio. And again, we're broadcasting to you live from Amman, Jordan, where it's still warm. We're in the upper 80s. The breeze has picked up a bit. That's a great thing. You know, it's kind of cool. I'm broadcasting, looking out my window here, and I got an open field straight in front of me, so I can see the trees kind of waving there. And I see a lot of a breeze, but all the windows are shut right now because there's a lot of street noise, and the mosque is going to go off pretty soon here, and we don't want that to be interfering too much with the show. So anyways, welcome everybody. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Just a reminder, we do have two guests coming up. Jack Sen is going to be visiting us, former UKIP party member, and David Gary from ErasingTheLiberty.com, ErasingTheLiberty.com. Again, those two guests, hour number two and hour number three for the show. This is listener-sponsored and supported radio. It does rely upon your donations to help keep the network alive, up and running. And obviously, we need the platforms, folk. All of this censorship and deplatforming, it's all very, very serious, and it's all very, very real. If you know the history of Revolution Radio, Dennis Fetcho, The Fetch, and everything else, you should know very, very well that when I started this business, Jews made a huge effort to get me deplatformed. Bottom line, folks, they have been trying to deplatform me since the 2000s, 2003, 4, 5, and on up. They tried to deplatform me at Oracle Broadcasting. They tried to deplatform me here at Revolution.radio. And Revolution.radio, they stood up for me and literally said, no, you know, we hear a lot of problems. Hey, we have the right message. We have the right formula. We have the right tact to take when it talks about contemporary problems that we are facing in the political scene. We are not going to continue to take this willy-nilly approach and try to just wishy-washy it to make it nonsense. Folks, it's not what we're here for. We deal on the political level. We're not dealing in American politics at a senior level, but I do deal in international politics on a senior level. I hear what government officials say about the United States. I hear what sometimes people within our own government, within state, talk about our government. Guys, I hear things. I understand what's going on. We have a huge problem, from the immigration crisis to the financial crisis to the foreign policy, which is run out of Israel, Tel Aviv. We've got a lot of problems here, folks, and we need platforms in order to operate. We need to have a voice to reach people and reach people effectively, and that is what allows or is allowed through Revolution Radio. So again, we appreciate if you take that $5 and you spend it every month. Folks, that's $1 a show. Come on, it's $1. It ain't even that. Excuse my language, ain't even that. But it's not even that if you are listening to both shows. If you're listening to both Thursday and Saturday, folks, that's 20 hours of programming that we are doing here on Revolution Radio. 20 hours. That's not a joke. That's serious time. That's serious effort. And that goes into my work, and that's the studio work to bring in the show. So, folks, it's more than worth it. More than worth it if you would take the time and just put $5 a month, make it recurring to revolution.radio. Again, 100 of you people, that's $500 a month. That competes with some of the private individuals that are helping to fund the station right now, okay? Literally. So do what you can. And again, that gets us a lot of credence out there, a lot of street cred, because it shows that our listeners have a lot of interest in supporting Inside the Eye Live. And that's all we're doing. We're supporting Inside the Eye Live. Other shows out there, they have to raise equally money too. So hopefully we got 83 shows out there. We put together the bills each and every month and the platform rolls on. Let's see. It's time for the ITEL Cat Report. The ITEL Cat Report continues, and thank you so much for that, to be proudly sponsored by North Kakalaki Trading Post. Good services and solutions for all creatures, great and small. It is inconveniently located at the corner of Walk and Don't Walk and by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club, a radio show hosted by our very own Blackbird Nine. I'm not even in the chat room yet. Let me kind of scroll in there and see who's there. I haven't even checked. Is Blackbird in today? It's loading, everybody. I don't see him up front. He might be working. I'm not going to scroll because I got to talk, everybody. But it's chat room again, InsideTheEyeLive.com. Click on the live chat button. So again, click on the live chat button. That will get you in the door. But nonetheless, it's the ITEL Cat Report again by Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. He's generally in the chat room as Blackbird Nine, and he's got a radio show every Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on the Spreaker Radio Network. And, of course, that costs some money. Also, all the platforms cost money, folks. So, nonetheless, we'd like to thank Blackbird for that. And this week's ITEL Cat Report continues with the new development with the new kitten. We've got this new kitten, and his name is Spikers. That's right, Spikers. And Spikers is a pretty cool cat, very friendly cat. We let him in the house all the time. And we kind of guard him. We protect him. But we're like, shh, shh. You know, we're conspiring with Spikers to keep him from being seen by Bruiser. Bruiser doesn't like anybody. Bruiser is so cute. He just stands at the door with his paws over the door where he's looking out through the opening in the door where the cats can actually come in. And he just looks and sniffs and smells because he can't see the cat. And it's just so fun to watch these two kind of go around in circles when they're not fighting. We did have a big fight this week. I think we had two fights this week. And then we had Bruiser got into big, big, big trouble about an hour ago. And that's because I have a couch right here in my office. And Bruiser was kind of riled up because he's been trying to fight off this cat and the new kitten. And he decided to mark his territory on my couch. And of course, that's not a good thing to do. He got chased up and outside. He's up on the roof pouting right now. I guarantee that because he just came over, just marked the couch. I'm like, dude, get the heck, get out. And so, yeah, I chased him outside. So he's going to be upstairs for a while because I don't like cats marking my furniture. That ain't a cool thing to do. So if he wants to go mark his territory, go outside and mark your territory, dude, not inside the house. So he's in trouble. Bruiser's in a little bit of trouble, but he's been a sweetheart a lot lately. He's been a great cat as always. One eye's inside the house now. I don't know where he's at, but he's somewhere in the side. But it's been very quiet. We're going to have a big party, by the way, after the show. A big party, about 10 people. Mostly gals, because I'm actually going to be leaving Jordan here by the end of the month. So my vacation, and I know you guys feel so bad for me because it's only a 3.5 month vacation. I know you guys are starting to feel bad for me that I've had so much time off and I'm going to have to go back to work in Saudi Arabia and all that cool stuff. But, you know, you guys, it's tough to leave home too, because when I leave, it's kind of like being in the military. You're gone for 6 months, 7 months, 9 months. Maybe you get a week off, 2 weeks off if you're lucky. So it's not easy. It's a good work. It's good. I'm good at what I do. You know, I like to not patting myself too hard, but I am good at what I do and I am appreciated, and that's a great thing. And I'm looking forward to get back to work for sure. So, the cats are going to miss me. That's the other part of the cat report. This office is going to get shut down after I leave and the cats are going to be gone. But anyways, guys, that's kind of like the ITEL cat report. Not a whole lot to speak. We got the new cat. I think I hear one eye right now asking to go outside, or he's at the door asking to come inside because all the doors are shut right now. Maybe he's at the front door asking to come inside, but I hear one eye right now. He's talking. I think he wants to come inside the house, not to go outside. Anyways, that's the ITEL Cat Report. Again, proudly sponsored by Blackbird, North. Bye. Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. Again, Blackbird Nine's Breakfast Club. Be sure to check out Blackburn Nines Breakfast Club every Wednesday evening on Spreaker. For more information, visit BlackBird9TradingPost.org. That's BlackBird9TradingPost.org. And again, Frederick, I know a lot of you guys that listen to this show listen to Frederick's show too, and you guys know darn well that's a really good show. Right now, let's keep this show moving right along.
Oy vey. Oy gewalt. It's like another shower.
Oy vey.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, everybody.
How is it run by Jews? It's owned by Jews. Very goddamn angry at some of the Jews.
I thrive on boy and tears.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, everybody.
Oy vey.
The Oy Vey Moment is proudly sponsored by Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, author of The Synagogue of Satan, Updated, Expanded, and Uncensored. The Synagogue of Satan, Updated, Expanded, and Uncensored features a rapturous 144,000 words that is replete with additional articles never before seen in print. And after having its distribution banned by Amazon and Lulu, The Synagogue of Satan, Updated, Expanded, and Uncensored is now available from Barnes Review at barnesreview.org. Order your copy today, won't you? Of course, don't forget to listen to Andy's The Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show, which streams every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock a.m. to 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern on Eurofolk Radio at eurofolkradio.com. To listen, simply visit eurofolkradio.com during showtime and click on the Listen Live Now link, or visit andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com for Andy's free show archives, which comprises one of the most extensive guest lists in the alternative media. And this week's Oy Vey Moment is coming to us from really Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, my computer is freezing here. That's not a great thing. But yeah, my computer is freezing. Not sure why that is. Let me see if I can get this thing to go. It's probably the website that's behind it. But see, what's happening is this week we've got the Unite the Right, what do you call this? The Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. And there was a, they're going to have a, basically a lot of Jewish groups are getting together, and they're going to be having some type of activity around memorializing the Charlottesville thing. Now, mind you, get this. This is a bunch of Jewish groups are getting together to, quote unquote, fight against racism, fight against white nationalism, fight against white supremacy. Now, if you notice, it's not we who are the supremacists in the nationalist patriotic movement here. It is this minority Jewish group that continues to impose itself upon the rest of us. And keep that in mind as you guys move forward. Who is doing the imposing? Who is doing the dictating? Who is asking or calling for laws to block other people from having a voice? It's not the whites and the conservatives and the patriots here in America. It's all coming from these various Jewish groups. So we have this Unite the Right rally. And again, we've had people here coming on the show, like Lee Rogers attended that thing. Kevin McDonald came in to speak about it. But what is happening here is that the Jewish side of our political spectrum are becoming exceedingly totalitarian. They are essentially blocking speech in pretty much every facet that they feel is necessary to preserve their narrative. For instance, the Holocaust, you know, in pretty much so many parts of Europe now, you can't even talk about it without risking going to jail. How insane is that? Now, if it's a lie, and nobody's ever allowed to talk about it, and then Jews are allowed to continue to extort billions upon billions and enact laws that create tyranny upon all of us, and nobody's even allowed to talk about it. This, to me, is supremacy, Jewish supremacy. Now we have this issue of the Unite the Right rally. And there's a guy, he was, I don't know which one, what thing he was, but his guy Gavin McGinnis, he's basically a flaming tutu faggot, to use I guess street language. The guy's a faggot. He's disgusting. He takes dildos and he puts them where you wouldn't, you know, basically on his own podcast. The guy's disgusting. He's a scumbag. He's out there talking all the time about how the Nazis this and the Nazis that, and but I'm pro white. He's not pro white. He's just one of these LGBTQP activists operating within the white nationalist space, and he carries the message, and he's had trolls like Andrew Arnheimer and all of these other trash people on. The guy's garbage, but he has a huge following. I think he's on Rebel Media or something like that, another Jewish organization. So he's getting a lot of play. Now, what's happened is that, again, we don't have to agree with these people, but he, for what it's worth, would at least spread some pro-white messaging out there. But he got booted off of Twitter permanently this week. Again, another voice absolutely silenced. And they did it. Why? Because you've got the Unite the Right rally going on. But the Unite the Right rally now is all about Jews censoring everybody else, celebrating the fact that they were able to shut down the Nazis, shut down the white nationalists, shut down the supremacists out there. Oh, we have combated Nazism. We are Jews. We are so great. Look at us, America. We're saving you from Nazis. What they're not telling you is that they are absolutely imposing upon you Jewish Bolshevism, which killed more people than the Germans ever would have dreamed of doing. Now, he was, again, McGinnis has been calling for his Proud Boys, the Proud Boys, a bunch of flaming faggots, basically, I guess. It sounds like it. Anyways, I don't know if I'm accurate there, but it sure sounds like it, to come and counter demonstrate at this Unite the Right rally that's going on. So essentially, we've got big tech taking down Alex Jones. Alex Jones, again, for better or worse, it's up to you to decide. He spread a lot of information. He's an idiot, quite frankly, on certain issues. You could even call him a propagandist. You could even call him a traitor, because he knows what's going on, yet he is still aiding and abetting the enemy of this country, which is, start with the fake news. Start with, again, the fake news. But who owns the fake news? The fake news is owned 94% by Jewish groups. When you bore deeper down into this Jewish monstrosity called Jewish culture within our lands, you're going to find that they all support Jewish media. They all, not, you know what I mean, by all is essentially everybody. Just to clear up how we're using that word for those guys. Oh, you can't say the word. Oh, you can't do that. But folks, this Jewish political power base, they 100% support Jewish media. Because Jewish media, and they work hand in hand. Now, you can talk about deep state and all that. Yeah, that's all true, too. But right now, we're talking about one faction of this, one tentacle of this octopus that seeks to dominate America here. Gav is getting banned again. I don't care, quite frankly, because the guys, I'm not here to have a bunch of gay, retarded idiots represent me and my group. I don't need it. So I don't care on a personal level. I don't care whether Gavin McGinnis gets taken down. Anybody that's going to take dildos and put them on a show and put the, I ain't got any time for this type of depraved idiot. As far as I'm concerned, he's a scumbag. Get rid of him. But we still have the larger issue of internet censorship. The big tech companies following Jewish groups out there seeking to dominate and control the narratives, no matter where that narrative seems to pop up. I was thinking today about YouTube. I'm going to call that, I think, now, just to cut it short. That will be the Oy Vey moment, essentially, is, again, this internet censorship, Jewish groups having their own rally. Again, multiple Jewish groups, folks, are being given their own rally inside of Charlottesville, I believe, is where this is at. This story is not very good, but I believe it's inside Charlottesville. And yet Twitter, YouTube, all these major tech companies are saying, you Americans, you don't have a right to counter-protest. You don't have a right to go there and say, you Jews are wrong. You don't represent us. You see, why not? I mean, at some point in the political process, we are going to have to be able to generate tens of thousands of people to voice their concerns against Jewish power and domination. Look, power never exceeds anything without a demand. It never has. It never will. If you are not willing to confront power, power will eat you up. It's very simple. In the case of Jewish domination here, it's partially your police. You know, there's a whole gamut of control mechanisms out there. But at the end of the day, everything is the people. Everything is the people. You know, there's a story coming out of Italy. The Italian, this Jewish anti-human agenda is so pervasive. In Italy, what they did is when you went to get your birth certificates and some of your legal documents from the government signed, you know, you didn't put mother and father on the birth certificate. You know what they put? Parent one, parent two. Why? Maybe because you had a bunch of leftist, gay, transgender, cannibal, Jewish people working to undermine the civilization that is known as Italy, the country that is known as Italy. Therefore, it's not mother, it's not father, it's parent one and parent two. Oh, this is necessary because that way we can have a bunch of gay people saying this is parent one, parent two. There's no mother, father anymore. What type of idiocy are Jews trying to push on everybody? And everybody's kind of like laying back right now, being silent. Maybe a large majority of the people out there really don't grasp just how serious everything is right now. They don't get it. Maybe they're still sleepwalking. But folks, a lot of us do get it. And a lot of us continue to voice it. Now, Italy, again, to their credit, Matteo Salvini, he's the prime minister, said, we are going to support. We are going to support the family, the traditional family, mother and a father and a child. Now, why do you Jews have a problem with that? Why is it a problem for the Jewish people out there to say that there's a mother, a father, and a child? Now, that may sound absurd to a lot of us, but to Jews, that's a serious issue. There's no such thing as a mother. There's no such thing as a father. It's parent one and parent two. And joining us, I think I can get this call in before we go to a break here. Hi, welcome to Inside the Eye Live.
Hey, Fetch, how you doing? This is Stan Hess in Idaho. How's it going, man?
I didn't recognize that. Yeah, okay. Hi, Stan. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. I just finished a book that will show you. Well, you lived down there in the L.A. area. It's called Full Service. It's written by this guy named Scotty Bowers, who was basically a guy that arranged sex for just hundreds of people in Hollywood. And, you know, I'm no prude, but this really ripped the veil off of the whole Hollywood scene and to see what a lot of these actors were all about. It's disgusting. So I wanted to mention that. I also have been looking at the idea of sanctuary, this term, this word sanctuary. Basically, Hollywood is a sanctuary. It's a nation within a nation. All of these colleges in the United States, and I could say probably in all the world where European Christian people are still a majority, these places are used to propagandize the youth to turn on their own society.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where I'm going with this other than, the other thing is I just want to mention something, too, about this book called Hollywood Party that came out in 1997. And it's a book about the Communist Party in Hollywood. And basically, to boil it down, what happened in Hollywood is Louis B. Mayer and Zanuck and all these other Warner and all these other clowns, they acted as if they were doing something about the communist influence. Well, in in effect, they were just giving lip service to it. And what they did is they allowed these guys and women to work under assumed names, which is, you know, is what the Bagel Boys are really good at. You know, just change my name. And So I wanted to connect that up with the SDS, because I just finished a book called SDS, written by this guy, Frederick Sali. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It was written in 1970, and it lays out, it doxes basically all the characters that were involved. And it was very Jewy. I was a Trotskyist at one time, these guys that were in the SDS, and then which eventually then it, you know, it split apart, and then you had the Weathermen. It was heavily Jewish influence. That's what I saw when I went to Berkeley, is that these guys, they and women, they seemed to know everything, like they had actually been in Moscow. And then, of course, when I woke up, and then I realized that whereas a lot of us grew up and we were talking about sports or movies or something like that, with our parents or friends or whatever, all of these characters, they talked about the Bolshevik Revolution and how do we make it nice and fuzzy by calling it communism, kind of like community or in common. And so these people, they have never given up. And what happened with the SDS and the Weathermen, they actually screwed the black community, because here are all these white kids that are playing upon the blacks' worst instincts, which is the white man is the evil of all the world. And so we need to kill the pig. We need to off the capitalist pig, the pig policeman, pig this, pig that. And that contributed to the breakdown of the black community. And so, yeah,
you know, in the throw it in some real quick, you know, because in the 50s, 60s, you know, with Ford, actually Ford said everybody is welcome. Black, it didn't matter. And he really contributed to helping people in the black community raise themselves up. As you say, the communists have destroyed it. Dan, we're in a break. Thanks for calling in. Guest coming up, Jack Senth, coming up right after the break, everybody. It's the Fetch.
Great.
Thanks. Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the aware. Back with more right after this. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's the Fetch, Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. It's what? Saturday morning, everybody. Good morning to all of you listening out there in the United States and Canada. And, of course, wherever you're listening out there, hope all's going well here. We've got Jack Sen is going to be joining us here. I think he's already connected, but let me try to get this thing out of the way first. And that would be who Jack Sen is. Come on. There's my touch screen. It's not – my screen is, like, very slow today. It's like it's going to freeze, and I don't want my whole thing to freeze. That would be very bad. But I think I got to do something on my laptop. Let me see. Hold on. Jack is a former UK UK party member. Put it that way. And he's appeared on a lot of different shows, the Brian Roos Show, among many. He's got his own radio show, Network Resistance Radio, and he follows a lot of international politics. So he's based up in Ireland right now, and he is standing by. So without further ado, Jack, welcome to Inside the Eye Live.
Hi, how's it going, Dennis? Yeah, I'm in England, actually, in the northwest of England.
Ah, I thought you told me Ireland the other day while we were
No, England.
Okay, not a problem. Well, jolly old England, for those, it's okay
for
me.
Yeah, the northwest. I'm actually about 20 minutes from Liverpool in a place called Southport. It's sleepy. Where I live is a sleepy village called Birkdale. It's right on a golf course where every few years the British Open is held at Royal Birkdale, and that's literally, well, I can see it. Well, kind of. If I stand on my second floor balcony, I can see it in the distance. It's a very nice community. Community.
It would be fantastic to live off of a golf course unless you're too close and you start taking some errant balls through your windows because people.
No, it's not that close. We're about 60. I'd say probably about 60 yards from the boundary of the fence, and then the course is probably
okay.
About 100
yards past. Just out of curiosity, what hole are you off of?
14th.
The 14th. Okay, cool. That's
pretty cool.
If you said, I don't know, you know, we weren't taking you so seriously. So far, you're not giving me fake news back. Sounds good.
I actually don't really play golf. I did it in school. I took a couple of golf courses when I was at university for an elective. You're allowed to take, I think, four sports courses over 4 years for four credits at university. I took golf, skiing, tennis, and a racquetball.
That was the good old days where they kept us in shape.
It was, yeah. It was a great fun. I probably enjoyed golf the least of the four, but I did enjoy golf.
I used to golf. I could smack that ball 300 yards. The problem was I could never make it go straight.
Yeah, and me too. I struggle with having it go straight as well. I could smack it far, but it wouldn't go where I wanted it to.
Yeah, I could never get it to go straight. Anyways, Jack, welcome back. I'm just curious. I didn't do my homework. When were you last here on the show? Do you remember? 2 months ago?
Yeah, I was on right before Ken O'Keefe because that's all I recall. Probably about 2 months. I think I was on the episode before Ken O'Keefe and I think one after Patrick Little, if I remember correctly. So whatever that was.
Yeah, that was.
So it would have been during the run up to the election.
That was before we were doing the live stream. So everybody, if you want to see how handsome Jack Sen is, I've got his picture up there from his from his Skype feed. He's now up on the screen on the Inside the Eye Live YouTube channel. So check it out again at Inside the Eye Live's YouTube account. So inside, what is that? YouTube user Inside the Eye Live. You guys can find it. You guys should be smart enough to get over there. Jack, you were talking the other day to me privately, and it's something that we haven't covered at all here. And it's a really big deal, but we haven't covered it. And that was the flotilla of craft, small craft, trying to make its way over to Palestine, which is theoretically not under the control of the Israelis. And the Israelis blocked that one again. Can you give us some updates what happened with that flotilla? Because honestly, we didn't cover an ounce of that thing.
Yeah, I don't know much about it. I mean, I'm good friends with a gentleman by the name of Ron Kukal. Or Kukal. He served aboard the USS Liberty. So 50 odd years ago, I think it's probably 51 plus years ago, USS Liberty was attacked by the Israeli government, false flag. They tried to pin it on the Egyptians. I'm sure your listeners know the whole story. So Ron served aboard that. He was actually below deck when the torpedoes hit. He heard a voice in his head that he should duck and hit the deck, and he did. And he survived. He's witnessed many of his brothers die aboard USS Liberty. And he's been on a crusade since then to expose the Zionist Israeli attack on, you know, a British naval vessel. So he and I were speaking about 2 weeks ago, and he mentioned that one of his buddies, I don't remember but it was one of the guys who served aboard the Liberty who's still also with us. And he was actually on a ship traveling towards Palestine in order to bring them some humanitarian aid, some food, some medical supplies. And I don't recall what happened because I really wasn't following it, but they were blocked and they were struggling to obviously land where they were in their intended location. Obviously, they feel great sympathy towards the Palestinians. I mean, people who've been oppressed by a nation, as these men have been for 50-odd years, you know, they've been silenced and abused and persecuted by the Israeli government for 50 years. They feel a kinship towards the Palestinians who themselves are abused on a daily basis by the same government.
It's terrible.
So, yeah, it is. It's a horrific situation over there. And, you know, whether we're a Christian or whether we're a white nationalist or just an American or a British civic nationalist, I think – you know, we can all recognize at this point if we have our heads fighting a battle against the same people they are, if we really are honest with ourselves.
Yes.
So, you know, I think we should sympathize with them. And whether you're.
I'm not a big fan of Palestinians directly, but I see no reason why the American people should not agree to arm the Palestinians and let themselves and then block, of course, Israel and let them just defend themselves, you know. Because what's going on now is absolutely beyond human imagination, the amount of just unilateral slaughter that the Jewish people are allowed to get away with over there. It's unconscionable.
It is. And, you know, things I grew up actually – I mean, one of the things that led me to this message is I grew up around the Jewish people. I grew up in – as you probably can tell by my accent and the speed of my speech, I grew up in the New York metropolitan area. Although I'm British – my mother and father moved to Connecticut when we were very young, just outside of Westchester County, and we lived in Westchester.
Connecticut is a big Jewish area. I mean, that's a lot of Jewish money.
And we lived in Westchester as well as New Jersey. So I grew up around Jewish people for about 12 years of my life. And, you know, coming from a unicultural environment in Britain, I was only five, but, you know, obviously my mother, was staunchly pro-British and, you know, everything in the house was British and she was an Anglophile, although she was also British. Moving to a multicultural environment where the Jews control the shots and they kind of pit different groups against one another, I kind of learned early on, you know, what we were up against. And then, of course, you know, although the Talmud does teach adults to conceal their animosity towards Gentile people, children who are raised in Jewish homes aren't able to do so as easily. So although, you know, the Talmud does tell the Jewish people that they have to conceal their hatred towards Gentiles, Jewish kids, they get the bit about hating Gentiles, but they haven't kind of grasped the bit about how to hide their hatred.
They haven't grasped how dangerous it is to openly voice it yet.
Yeah, exactly. Have not, no. And so, you know, growing up around them and recognizing that it wasn't right what I was seeing, what I was hearing, what I was experiencing, I recognized that there were different factions. There were Italians who hung together. I actually hung out with the Italians for whatever reason. And then there were the Irish, and then there were the Jews, and there were the Asians, and there weren't any blacks where we lived. But everybody was kind of, you know, it was balkanized, the school. And for me, this was peculiar because, you know, again, I spent the first 6-7 years of my life in Great Britain, and you didn't experience this sort of balkanization at school level. And then recognizing that the teachers who were predominantly Jewish, the contempt they had for non-Jewish students, and in particular, and I was kind of a rebel. I don't know how that's possible, but I was kind of a rebel. I didn't kind of tolerate the fact that I was being downgraded. I recognized that I was as smart as, or if not smarter, than the vast majority of the Jewish students, but my grades weren't reflecting my performance in the classroom. So obviously I expressed my anger and my contempt for my surroundings. I was pulled out of that school quite early on and brought to a Lutheran preparatory school. And then I went to a top university. It always stuck with me how it was an uphill battle that I faced at that Jewish school. Although it was public school, it was, in my opinion, a Jewish school. It was run by Jews, Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews. I recognized early on that, you know, you can't win against these people when they're in their packs. They're very tribal. They fight for one another first and foremost. Their contempt for outgroups, Gentiles, whites, it's just incredible. And, I did recognize early on that this was going to be a major, it's going to be a major part of my life moving forward as well. I wanted to kind of expose this at university, and I attempted to do so when I was at university as well. And yeah, I think that when you grow up in that sort of environment, you can't help but feel sympathy towards people who you know are facing that same sort of evil. And that's why I side with the Palestinians. It really has nothing to do with them. It's really to do with the fact that they're fighting the same battle I fought.
Yeah, Jack, what's fascinating to me is that a lot of people attack the Jewish issue through the Palestinian eyes. And I've known even other radio hosts, and they listen to the show. They know who initially that's where they started is dealing with this Jewish issue through Palestinian eyes, Palestinian issues. And it's like, hey, wake up. You got just as serious a problem on your own shores, in your own backyard, in your own towns that the Palestinians have. It's time for you to start focusing on your local issues equally. And boy, you in the UK right now, what a basket case. Maybe I'm just in a shell, Jack, and I'm just seeing too much because of the how I bring in my Twitter feed. But it seems to me that the UK is in overdrive right now with Jewish groups attacking the political status quo, going after Jeremy Corbyn. There is nothing this guy seems he can do without Jews, mainly Jews, making this such a huge deal, even to the part of colluding in their magazines running the same headline. What's happening?
It is a mess. And, you know, it's very difficult because I'm obviously on the far right, and the far right, sadly, is more pro-Jewish and pro-Zionist than the far left. So I really struggle existing in the far right at this point because of the fact that, you know, although we do have some genuine nationalist movements, including the one that I'm involved with, Liberty Defenders, the vast majority of people on the far right are so obsessed with Islam because they've been indoctrinated to such an extent by, you know, the Jewish leadership on the far right and people who are owned by the Zionist lobby on the far right, that, you know, it's actually very hard to exist on the far right. And like you said, Jeremy Corbyn, who is far left, but he's obviously quite pro-Palestinian. And he's been critical of private broadband. And although he is himself Jewish, he actually supported by the Jewish community. The Jewish community supported the Tory Party, which is the Republican Party in Great Britain, you know, the equivalent of the Republican Party. And the Tory Party, David Cameron, who is a Gentile through and through, although there's some rumor he has some Jewish ancestry, he was the person that the Jewish community chose to support over their own Ed Miliband, because of the fact that Miliband is a bit wishy-washy in their opinion on Israel. So really, for the Jews in Britain, as is the case in the United States, really, it's all about Israel. It's all about their agenda. It's not really about the country in which they inhabit. In Great Britain, Tommy Robinson is seen as the champion of the far right. But if you look closely at who this man is,
he's an Israeli. You
know, he's an Israeli, perhaps an Israeli citizen. He's admitted he's actually Jewish. His name is like Yaxley something or other. Yes. Originally, it's not really Robbins. Yeah. You know, he has said he's a Zionist 100%. He has also said that he's actually of Jewish ancestry. He takes his money from the Shulman Group based in the United States, the Horowitz Foundation, again, another Zionist, Likud Zionist lobbyist group based in, I think, D.C. or perhaps New York. I believe he gets some money from the Koch brothers as well, from what I've heard. He has nothing to do with the British working class, although he presents himself as the champion of the working class. He's literally shilling for the Jewish establishment in Great Britain as well as the Zionist lobby in the United States. And it's quite appalling that, you know, we sit here arguing all day long about how bad the Muslims are. We can all agree that there's a lot of problems with the Islamic community. Yes. And I'm no fan.
I'm going to Saudi Arabia, Jack.
Yanara, danger.
Yeah, I'm going to be going to Saudi in a couple of weeks, okay? And what they did in Saudi Arabia is, in order to create jobs for the Saudi people, they kicked out everybody in certain retail sectors. So now if you go to like a Carrefour, the French Carrefour chain, and you want to buy a cell phone, right? Or Carrefour, you guys would know in the West for the most part. And you want to buy a cell phone in the daytime, because women in the Muslim world, for the most part, are in home by 10 o'clock. Fathers don't want them out late. If you're not married, why are you out late? You don't need to be home. You don't need to be out playing after 10 o'clock. So most of the – if you go to like a club – not a club, but a restaurant here in Amman, and it's mainly Muslims, you'll find some beautiful women here. No hijab, nothing. They're just out. They're all – but by 10 o'clock, they leave. Why? Because they're Muslim and the father wants them home, that type of thing. Then you go to Saudi and they're all in burqas. Yeah, they're all in burqas in Saudi. And Boris Johnson came out this week and said something about the bank robbers and something like that about the burqa. And everybody blew up at that. Tell a little bit about that story if you can.
Yeah, I don't really follow the news that much. I'm kind of living on a rural farm. But, I mean, at the end of the day, people like Boris Johnson and Jacob Rees-Mogg, they present themselves as the champion of kind of now the white Christian British man and woman. But at the end of the day, they're just shilling for the Jewish lobby as well. I mean, the greatest threat to Great Britain is not really the people that are living in the country from Islamic countries, because they can be easily sorted. I mean, you tell them literally, you're not going to have any more children. We're not going to pay your benefits if you have more children. That's the end of it. And they'll stop having children. The only reason they have eight children is because they realize the British government's going to give them money until they have the eighth child. Yes. They'll stop bringing their relatives in.
Some very nice, intelligent. Yes. I'm not a big fan of your Pakistani community, you know, because I've had a lot of run-ins with them. I find them, a lot of them are like on the even more radical and racist than you might Saudi Arabia would be, quite frankly.
Oh, much worse.
I find them almost repulsive. But I have met a few that are very kind, very generous, very, very nice, very intelligent. Yep. And they say, man, the government, it's like stupid. Why is the British government so stupid by allowing all of these migrants
of course,
to have all these children?
Of course. I mean, I think the point, though, is that it's not the Muslims who are campaigning to have them brought in. That's correct. It's the far left and the Zionist lobby that campaigns for these wars in the Middle East that destabilize the region, which results in refugees, right? And then, of course, it's in the West, it's Jewish groups predominantly fighting for mass immigration into the country. I mean, the Muslims really have no power. They're not in the media. I mean, there are no Muslims on television, really. The vast majority of people who run the media in the West are of Jewish ancestry. So it's not really the Muslims who are controlling our immigration policy. If you look at who controls our immigration policy, as Barbara Spector quite eloquently said, and she could say it better than I can, the Jews are going to be resented for the fact that they're the ones who are behind the immigration racket. And that's the case here. The Jews are behind the immigration racket, and they're behind the hate speech legislation. So we can't criticize the Muslims because of laws that people like Harry Cohen and Jared Kent in the last 2, 3, 4 decades. We can't criticize them because of these laws. These are laws that Jews created. And why are they coming in? Well, again, it's the wars in the Middle East. It's the immigration racket. It's George Soros. It's not Mohammed, what's his name, from Bradford or Leeds, who's involved with the immigration racket. These people benefit from Jewish involvement in immigration and the war machine. They certainly benefit, no doubt in my mind they benefit, but they're not the ones behind it. We could stop them if we wanted to in a heartbeat. They don't have the intellect or the money to really do much without the bad guys pulling all the strings.
Yes. And with all the Corbyn thing, I've been following the Corbyn a lot because, you know, just recently he was inside of Tunisia. I don't know if you saw that story. He was inside Tunisia laying a wreath at some Palestinian martyr, and supposedly two graves next door was one of these Palestinian terrorists who was involved in the Munich attack. You know, it just doesn't seem to stop right now, that it's a full-on court press by the Jewish community to just attack everything that we're trying to do.
Of course it is. Yeah, I'm going to give you a couple of examples. I mean, my partner in crime with Liberty Defenders is a gentleman by the name of Timothy Scott, who is going to be on the program with us today, but he's had to travel with work. And he's a former British soldier who famously traveled back to the Middle East to fight ISIS himself as a volunteer alongside the Kurdish Peshmerga. And he was actually blocked from speaking at the recent free speech rally in London because he's critical of Israel. So the vast majority of the people that literally stand on stage claiming they're fighting for our right to speak freely in Great Britain are either themselves Jewish or shilling for the Jewish community. So you have people like Anne-Marie Waters, who's, you know, famously funded by Israel. And you have people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who is Jewish, Raheem Kassam, who he runs Breitbart London, but he also used to live in Jerusalem and write for Breitbart Israel, as well as write for the Jewish Post. People like Avi Yemeni. I mean, what's a guy like Avi Yemeni doing running the British far right? He's an Israeli citizen living in Australia who literally is Tommy Robinson's kind of handler in Great Britain. So these are the people who run the far right in my country. It's quite remarkable that, you know, we can't even get a sniff at these events. And it's not just Israel that they have a problem with. I mean, this is the scary part. Let's just say they were far right on every issue except for the Jewish question. Let's just say, for argument's sake, these people are actually far to the left on every single issue except for Islam. So they're pro-gay. So they're pro-LGBTQ. I mentioned Anne-Marie Waters. She herself is a lesbian from Ireland who fought for gay adoption and gay marriage. She's married to a woman. She's a leader on the British far right, although she's a, you know, former Communist Party leader in Ireland and in Britain. Then you have Milo Yiannopoulos, another homosexual, an advocate of transgenerational sexual relations between men and boys. He's openly pro-pederasty, and he's another leader on the far right. So the vast majority, Tommy Robinson himself has stated that he is a liberal. He's only against Muslims. So he's fine with Nigerian Christians coming into Britain. He's fine with, you know, gays adopting children. He's just not fine with the Muslims. So when you have the far right that's pushing pretty much a progressive agenda apart from Islam, fighting against the far left or progressives who support Islam, you really just have a battle between pro-Islam and anti-Islam, between leftists at the end of the day. So there's no far right left in Britain. It's gone. It's just completely gone.
That's almost kind of depressing because, yeah, as you describe it, that it all centers around Islam with Jews at the center, making sure that everybody is pro-Israel.
Yeah, basically. I mean, for example, Tommy Robinson, people on the far right support him, think he's wonderful. He's a hero for the white working class. I mean, he spent 13 months in prison, not for attacking a Muslim. He spent 13 months in prison for attacking a fellow nationalist, a veteran, headbutting a veteran in the face because the veteran was anti-Israel. So, I mean, this is what we're dealing with here. And this is a guy who's committed major financial fraud, mortgage fraud. It's a criminal, basically, a common criminal. Again, he's brave in some ways. He does put himself out there. But at the end of the day, he's funded by the Shulman Group and the Horowitz Foundation. I mean, anyone who's getting money from the Shulmans and Horowitzes and Kochs of the world is not going to be really working for the white working class. And these people are shilling for the Israeli lobby and the Jewish state. It's quite disturbing. It's quite disturbing.
In some respects, you paint a darker story than even for us Americans, because what you're really saying is there is no opposition right now in the United Kingdom.
No, there is none. Absolutely not. I mean, Liberty Defenders, my group, give the web address www.libertydefenders.org. We are a genuine opposition group, but we have few dozen members. We're only new. We're only 2 months old. So a few dozen members is good. I think we have 4 dozen members at this point, which is excellent. However, we're talking about if we put on an event, we have 20, 30 people, maybe 50 to 60 if we're lucky, which we had in the past when we ran British Renaissance. These people can spend £20,000-£30,000, put up a massive screen in the center of London. They have private security, have vans, satellite dishes. And this is the level of, the level of power they have compared to us. I mean, we literally have a budget of maybe £2,000 when we put it on an event. They have 30,000 to 40,000, 50,000 pounds. They fly in people from Israel. They fly in people from Australia, from Germany to speak. They have, they have security everywhere. And we tried to actually, because Timothy Scott, who I mentioned earlier, my partner in crime with the Liberty Defenders, he is quite well known on the freedom movement. He was not just dissuaded from speaking at the last Freedom event, he was pretty much told he couldn't speak by these pro-Jewish Zionists, fake far right.
Wow. Jack, going into a break. Hang tight, everybody. It's sure. Fed Inside the Eye Live, Intelligent Media, for the politically aware Jackson and this virtual stuff. Back with more. Welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, Intelligent Media for the Politically Aware. Today's date is August. I almost said April. August 11th. That's right. August 11th, 2018. I just want to remind everybody it's Zapopper's birthday over at grism.blogspot.com. So a happy birthday going out to Zap. He does all our archiving here at Inside the Eye Live. He does a lot of work. He does a lot of editing, and he's got some issues. So, folks, visit grism.blogspot.com. Support grism.blogspot.com. Joining us here now is former UKIP party member. And now, what is it? Liberty Defenders, I think?
Yeah, Liberty. Yeah, I run a variety of different sites. LibertyDefenders.org is one, and Resistance Radio. Andrew Bronze, Scott, I mentioned a variety of different people.
And that's Jack Sen, everybody. It looks like your picture has disappeared from my thing here, so I'm just going to kind of move over to a different type of thing here. But Jack Sen, everybody in the audience, join us in the YouTube live stream, YouTube at user is Inside the Eye Live. You can join us there. And, of course, the chat room, Inside the Eye Live. .com, InsideTheEyeLive.com. Click on the live chat button. That will get you in the door. Joining us from the 704 area code, Frank, welcome with Jack Sen.
Hey, I beg your pardon, Fetcho and guest. I just wanted to say, man, this guest is exceptional. He's covering all the key insight, all the key points that we don't hear enough.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Yeah. That's another key point that Frank calls in a lot. And he actually has a good point here, is that nobody's really covering the issues that you and I are covering so much. Who's behind it? I don't know if you've been following the Alex Jones clown show about how it's the communist Chinese. Mr. President, you're going to have to just sanction the Chinese. I just don't see it. I mean, you've basically talked about a complete capitulation of England now. The way you describe it, England has capitulated.
Totally. It's unfortunate. I think I can probably give you an example that it probably illustrates it better than anything else. There's a museum that's based in Liverpool, not too far from where I live. It's called the Merseyside Maritime Museum. So it's a museum that discusses the history of the British Navy, the trade between – from Liverpool especially. So obviously there was a slave trade at Liverpool. So, you know, understandably there is a – exhibit that discusses the slave trade, but they decided to kind of one-up things and call it the International Slavery Museum. We'll talk about, you know, the world's slave trade. So they get a lot of money from various organizations, including the EU, the British government, so the taxpayers funding this exhibit called the International Slavery Exhibit. So I went down to the museum with one of my friends, and I looked at the exhibit, and I saw no mention of the Barbary slave trade or the Jewish role in the slave trade or the African role in the slave trade or any other country's role in any slave trade whatsoever. Israel's role in the 21st century slave trade of Eastern European women. No, no mention of anything, just England's role in the slave trade. So I decided to go back with a friend of mine who's a barrister, a lawyer, basically a high-ranking lawyer. And we filmed this program outside this museum saying that, you know, why aren't they mentioning the Jewish involvement in the slave trade or the Muslim Barbary slave trade? So, you know, the various other slave – it's an international slavery museum, so it makes perfect sense. We were basically told by the police that were called that we shouldn't be there, that we were harassing people. We weren't. We were really merely making a video with a camera. I mean, we're educated people. We're not going to be, you know, harassing people trying to get into the museum to witness the propaganda. So the police agreed that we could stay there because we were on public property and there were no issues. So after I'd done this first video outside the museum, I decided to research this museum and find out, well, why weren't they talking about you know, the Barbary slave trade, which enslaved, what, 1.5 million or so white Europeans.
In fact, that's what America's first war was all about.
You precisely, know,
the Marines was about shutting down the Barbary trades. You know, how could you not talk about it?
Yeah, but they didn't refuse to mention it. So, you know, people were commenting on this wall, a lot of Jewish names, by the way, saying, oh, you're exaggerating the Jewish involvement. You know, it's the Muslims, the Muslims. So they try to twist this entire video I did, which was reaching hundreds of thousands of people, that, you know, really the Muslims are behind this kind of deliberate censorship. So I did a little digging, and the museum is run by a Jewish Marxist academic, okay? And this Jewish Marxist academic who teaches at this ridiculously poor university just outside Liverpool, which is, you know, for basically morons, no offense to anybody who goes there, but it's a, you know, really substandard university. He doesn't have a degree in colonial history that I have. He doesn't have a degree in international relations that I have. He doesn't have a degree in any sort of science whatsoever or any sort of, you know, even liberal arts degree. He has a degree in race relations from some trumped up phony university that hands out degrees in black studies and race relations. So what we have here is a race profiteer who is a Jewish Marxist academic basically selling his anti-white, anti-English hatred to the British government and the European Union government and getting millions of pounds in funding to spread anti-white propaganda. And remarkable, when I went back a second time to make a second video, I discovered they have a KKK exhibit in the museum now. What does a KKK have to do with the international slave trade? But there's an exhibit that condemns the KKK, and I was told there's going to be an exhibit that attacks apartheid. So we have a museum that attacks the English.
What do these have to do with slave trading? That's
nothing whatsoever. Nothing
whatsoever.
So and, this guy has no degree in anything to do with, you know, history.
The word slave comes from Slav, and that's because that's where Jews got their slaves from. So how can they not even talk about where the word came from?
I mean, the vast majority of the slave ships that launched banks and Jewish insurance houses. Most of the ships were actually owned by Jews. And, you know, a very few people from Liverpool have any connection to the slave trade whatsoever. They say, oh, you know, it built Liverpool. That's not entirely true. Yes, you know, a lot of money did come into the city, but the vast majority of it was taken by banking houses in London, as well as the individual, you know, the merchant himself. So very little of the money actually flooded the city. Liverpool was poor up until not so long ago. It was, you know, looking like a bomb had hit it up until about 1990. So, you know, you don't see any money from anything in Liverpool. Apparently the slave trade built this grand city. It's absolutely false. But, you know, this is the sort of propaganda they push. That's why we need to attack, you know, England's role in the slave trade. They did not mention Britain's Navy's role in the abolition of slavery. So, you know, Britain was the first country to truly take to the waves using public money to fight international slavery.
When was that?
They didn't mention
that. When was that?
You know, during the the middle part of the 19th century, the British Navy actually, after being sanctioned by Westminster, used public money to attack French, Portuguese, various slave ships to make sure that the slave trade stopped, the transatlantic trade, slave trade. I actually wrote an article about it for the Occidental Observer, for Dr. Ken McDonald's website, about a year or two ago. And, you know, today there's a booming slave trade still to this day in the Middle East, as you know, and of course in Israel, and even, you know, from Eastern Europe into Israel and into Western Europe. But there's no mention of that in the Slave Trade Museum as well. They only talk about England's role in, you know, the naughty white English role.
Yeah, what we seem to have a bigger problem now is really the human trafficking. That seems to be the big issue. Either legal human trafficking, which is done under the guise of labor contracts, you know, where you bring people in and then you work them like dogs, pay them a little bit. It's not technically slavery, but it's that they were certainly trafficked in. That seems to be the bigger issue to me, is the human trafficking side of it, of which obviously Europe is just, it's a full on invasion, where the human traffickers, it's estimated now to be something like a $36 billion industry.
Yeah. There was no mention of that. Should it mention that? Shouldn't they? Shouldn't they be mentioning modern slavery as well? No, nothing. Nothing at all. Just the, you know, the evil white Englishman's role in, you know, persecuting and oppressing the world's non-white population. That's really what the museum was about. And it wasn't run, again, by a black guy. It wasn't run by a Muslim. It was run by a Jewish Marxist academic.
Yeah. Do you find, because I certainly see it in America, probably UK too, with all the talk about the IHRA, this International Holocaust, whatever definition of anti-Semitism.
Unreal.
You know, it is unreal. But like this case here with this little museum, really, aren't we in a situation now where Jewish groups everywhere, they stopped working, and their only job now is to impose fake history everywhere they go?
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, what makes their control of historiography dangerous is the fact that they use it as like a club to bash us over the head with. So whenever we criticize mass immigration, they'll throw up the word Holocaust. Whenever we criticize Israel, they'll use the word Holocaust. So they'll point us to white role in slavery, that they've now crafted this narrative that, you know, every white man has a relative who owned a slave or something like that. You know, I mean, but again, if you look at the names of the people behind it, you know, if you look at the names of the people pushing this idea of white privilege, they're Jewish names. That's why it really troubles me when I see kind of white nationalists and, you know, far right people in Britain talking about the Muslims or the blacks. I'm like, give me a break. You know, the only black person I know on British television who's got a big enough mouth to talk about these issues has her surname is Hirsch. Hirsch is not an African surname. So, you know, she may look black, but she's obviously not fully black. So, you know, the vast majority of the people pushing this kind of anti-white narrative, you know, it's the same old people over and over and over again. It's the people that brought the minorities in. It's the people that pushed for hate speech legislation. It's the people that used the Holocaust as a battering ram anytime you criticize them. It's the people that, you know, are now attacking Jeremy Corbyn, as you pointed out, because he is not as good as they want on, you know,
it's purely Israel.
I mean, it's purely Israel.
Hey, you know, politics is really broken down to who's, and America is kind of the same way too. It's just not as open.
Yeah.
And they're not even shy about it in the UK. That's what impresses me. You have like Sussex, Friends of Israel, and all these other groups. They are just blatantly, openly advocating for Israel, Israel, Israel. And domestic politics of the British people be damned. And for me, I'm reading it as an American, you know, and I'm like, why aren't the British people just getting pissed off about this? Screw you, people. We want our people. Well, who are you? But I don't hear any protest or even a whimper of protest from the British people.
It's very difficult. I think that's
Islam. It's like, dude, you're off on burqas. You know, I was going to tell you the story. Jack, I got to go to Saudi, and I have to meet people like in those stores to buy a cell phone. And if you go during the day, you're always going to get the ladies, and the ladies are always in burqas. And when you first start, it is uncomfortable a little bit because it's not normal for us to talk like that. You can't see facial expressions. You can't read what they're thinking. So you go through the motions a little bit. You get used to it. But in our own countries, I'm all for it at the same time. You know, I don't care. If you want social norms that ban this type of stuff, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, I mean, my main problem with this, the entire narrative in the West that's hostile to Islam is not really Islam, because I'm not a huge fan of Islamism at all. I mean, I'd ban all Muslim immigration into Britain. I would, you know, I'm not like this sort of, I have no balanced approach to immigration. I'm against all mass immigration. And I think if, you know, perhaps Islamic immigration is probably even worse than non-Islamic immigration. However, I just really don't like being told who to hate by people who hate me. That really bothers me. You know, you're using me because they are Israel's enemy. You know, no way. And, you know, you made a really good point that, you know, it's really difficult when the far right is obsessed with Islam. But the good thing is, and this is peculiar that I may say this, that the far left is rotten as they are. They've totally turned on Jews in Britain to an extent where I would say the average left winger actually, I think, hates Jews now. So it's actually quite hilarious that you see, like, you know, the average far right person still, if you dig below the surface, doesn't like the Jews much. It's the far right. It's kind of hard to change people that quickly. But the far left, because the Jews are so openly hostile to their, you know, dear leader Jeremy Corbyn, who they love, you know, they really love this guy. You know, and Jeremy Corbyn has never made it, he's never hidden the fact, and my daughter's behind me. They've never hidden the fact that the Jews have never hidden the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is their enemy. So if you're a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, as the vast majority of kind of middle class leftists are, educated leftists are, you know, they obviously recognize that the people that are trying to take their beloved leader out are the Jews. So it's actually done them a great.
Guys, for our American and Canadian audience, man, it is so blatantly out in the open. It is unbelievable. Man. You have Hasbara from Israel supporting all of these Hasbara. It's amazing to watch what's going on with UK politics right now.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's I guess, like, I would like Jeremy Corbyn to, like, a anti-Semitic Bernie Sanders. That's the way I would describe him. He's like Bernie Sanders, but he doesn't like the Jews, you know. So it's and Bernie Sanders is obviously Jewish. So the same sort of clowns that like Bernie Sanders love Jeremy Corbyn. But unlike people who support Bernie Sanders and they're, you know, friendly towards Jewish issues, because Bernie Sanders is obviously pro-Israel, you know, the people who support Jeremy Corbyn, they recognize that their beloved leader is being attacked relentlessly by the Jewish lobby. So obviously they don't like the Jews anymore. So they've really harmed themselves in the process. You know, they've really harmed themselves.
I'm thinking now from a right, pro right. But as you say, there's so few out there. It's time to jump on the Corbyn bandwagon just to dilute the Jewish power, since that's the primary problem anyways. And then hope to fragment the movements further. Once you get rid of this Jewish problem, the other problems are going to surface faster, because right now it's all about Jews in the UK. There's no such thing as a British citizen. It's just Jews. That's it. It's about the Jews.
No, I agree with you 100%. I mean, we have been slowly but surely kind of hammering this issue to the right. We don't do so by basically saying the Jews are bad, because, you know, that is going to get you into trouble. I'm actually outside the UK now. I'm actually on holiday, so I can say these sorts of things. I'm based in England, obviously. That's where I'll be back in a couple of days. But if anybody listening who wants to report me, I'm actually on holiday in a third world country, so you can't do anything to me. But
is that how it works? You're free if you're not on the soil, but once you return, you got to follow the laws?
Basically, yes. Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty bad.
Hey, what about Scotland, man? I heard that they're going to open up the Scottish voting for all the immigrants, so that basically overnight the franchise of the citizens of Scotland have been diluted by 50%, something like that.
And this is the remarkable thing. Like, interestingly, if you only ask the Scottish people who've been indoctrinated to hate the English people, for obviously for generations, the English behave badly historically, so it's not been that difficult. And the Scottish have been anti-English for a long time as well. I have to just take care of something. But the Scottish National Party, which is not a national party, it's really a Marxist party that's anti-English.
Correct. It's an LGBTQ Jewish party.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It's a hideous party. But they recognize that although there is a lot of anti-English and anti-UK sentiment in Scotland, it's not strong enough that it will result in them being able to separate from the UK. So what they've done is they've basically encouraged everybody who's not of Scottish origin living in Scotland. So that includes blacks, Muslims, Poles, EU. They approach them differently. So they tell the Poles that although English will kick you out when they leave the EU, you can stay here because we'll be part of the EU if we leave the United Kingdom. So they've encouraged Poles by using the EU as a carrot. They encourage the blacks by pointing out the English are racist and this and the other. So the SNP, which is really a Marxist party dressed up as a nationalist party, they're using foreigners living in Scotland to basically destroy the United Kingdom.
But what amazes me is how do you go give a Polish person a right to vote in any part of the United Kingdom, let alone these Somalis, Nigerians, Ghanaians?
Yeah,
how do you
course,
do that?
Yeah.
How do you do it? I mean, I'm over here in Jordan. Some people just brought a bunch of stuff here because one of the girls got caught by the police and she's going to be deported. It's not like they just no, if you're not here legally, sorry, but you're going to jail now. And if you got friends in high places, you can fly home faster, but you're not going to get back out. Okay, no, you're not getting back
out.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
And it's the same in Saudi, same in everywhere in this part of the world. Yet us in the West, we got to deal with this Jewish crap, basically, of giving up our own national franchise to foreigners. It cannot bode well for our countries, period.
Okay, well, you know, obviously the Jews benefit when our societies are weakened. So, you know, they're doing it solely to, you know, push their own agenda and to, you know, it's a clever evolutionary strategy. I mean, the Jews, they're very good at this. I mean, I give them credit. It may sound kind of sick to say so, but if you look at them as a hostile element living in your midst, right? If you view them as a hostile outgroup, they may look like you and I in some way, some of them do, but they are a hostile element living in our countries. And so if you see them as a foreign body, you recognize that they're going to do what's right for their interests, and they do it very well. What troubles me is how they've been able to manipulate, you know, Gentiles to do their bidding for them. And so I have a bigger problem really with the Gentiles who serve them than I do with them. I can see a Jewish person and recognize, look, this guy's fighting for his people sort of thing. But what really troubles me is when someone like, you know, Tommy Robinson or Anne-Marie Waters or Raheem Kassam, who are really, you know, maybe they have a drop of Jew in them at some point, you know, way back, but they're really selling their own people out for a foreign power. And that really troubles me. I think that's why people say to me, oh, we should leave the right alone. Don't punch to the right. I'll say, no, I mean, these are dangerous, cancerous cells living in our body. We cannot allow them to exist in our body. Otherwise, they'll grow into malignant tumors. And that's why I really believe that we have to be aggressive when we go after, quote, right-wing people who sell this evil ideology, because they're the ones who really cause the trouble. Because, you know, the Jews really don't come out on their own. You don't see too many kind of Michael Weinsteins on the streets of England fomenting this sort of hatred. It's always going to be some kind of working class person who's getting paid off to shill for them. And that's why I think we really have to also go after the people that are doing the shilling on the streets.
Which is a challenge, because then you're going against this popular base that's been set up, and now all of a sudden you're looking like you're an enemy of the popular base, even though we're above the popular base and we see the game. That's why, isn't it better also just to focus a lot of times just on the Jewish issue, to risk the blowback within your own community?
Very difficult.
You broke up just a little bit there. Say that again.
No, it's been for quite a long time. Yeah, obviously, can abuse you and, you know, make your life a living hell if you do so. So what I've tried to do is try to, like, for example, when we attacked the slavery museum, we touched on a nerve. People were really angry that British and EU money was being used to fund this anti-white museum. So instead of saying it was the Jews, what we said was, look, they're deliberately ignoring the Muslims who are enslaved people. They're deliberately ignoring the blacks. And then we pointed out the museum was not run by a Muslim, though it was run by a Jewish academic. So we got the word Jew in there kind of subtly. Instead of saying it's the Jews, which will just land you in jail, we try to say, look, I mean, they're pushing this Muslim issue, they're pushing the blacks, but it's not really a British person doing this. This is actually a Jewish person doing this. So you then see like comments that say, oh, I had no idea, or yeah, how come there are so many Jews involved in this sort of racket? Mm-hmm. So you start to kind of lay the foundation. You kind of, you know, drop the breadcrumbs and lead them to grandma's house sort of thing. I think that's the right strategy. I really think that's a subtle approach. We have time still. I mean, we're not at a point. And again, when I say subtle, I don't mean we're going to spend 30 years dropping breadcrumbs. You know, we want to get to grandma's house in the next 6 months to a year. But we're getting to grandma's house. We're getting there. You know, people are getting red-pilled. But you don't want to scare them off by just saying something stupid where they say, you're an anti-Semite. I'm not supporting you. But like what I've done recently also, real quick, is I've tried to demonstrate that it's Jewish organizations that are fighting to protect halal food, because halal and kosher is nearly identical. So what I've demonstrated, it's really not Muslim money that's funding this halal fight. It's actually Jewish money that's funding the halal fight. And when people see that, they'll say, well, I had no idea that halal and kosher were the same. Ban them both. And that's what we're trying to get.
I was on Red Ice talking about that, man. It's a $2.1 billion industry. They're sucking $2.1 billion from Americans just for us to eat. How is that correct? In a country where we tax ourselves.
Precisely. But you have to, like I say, use like slightly clever tactics to get people to recognize. Like, you know, obviously when Timothy Scott was, we're concluding now. But it was great being on the program. I have enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great. Great final 15 minutes of strategy there too. So thanks for coming on, Jack.
Yeah, now the bad guys know.
There you go.
Thanks for having me.
Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware. Back with all right, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye, live intelligent media for the politically aware, right here on Revolution Radio at revolution.radio. Again, coming to you live from Amman, Jordan, where it's just getting after sunset now. At least the sun has gone down behind the hills. I don't see any sunset or any sunshine out there on the hill anymore. So it's kind of getting into the evening hours. So to those of you in America, still a good morning to you. I can hear my cat chirping away in the background. Joining us now again, Mr. David Gehry. I'm not sure how to say that. Gehry, I think it is Gehry. Again, he was a veteran that served in the United States Navy aboard the USS Skate, and that was and it probably still is a nuclear-powered fast attack submarine. And he was a nuclear propulsion operator on that ship. After retiring from the United States Navy, he worked in the radio business as a talk show host on stations in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, including WBAI, which was part of the Pacifica Radio Network. And he has interviewed many people around the world, including Hillary Clinton, Jesse Ventura, and hundreds more. So we are very pleased. By the way, he's also been a lot of our friends, people like Andrew Carrington, Hitchcock, people like that too, I believe. So, David, without further fanfare, welcomed Inside the Eye Live.
Well, great to be here, Dennis. Can you hear me okay?
You're coming through fine, and I got my cat Bruiser here who's blind chirping at me in the background. Is he coming through okay?
I don't hear the cat. Hopefully, I'll
everybody
hear him
loves
later.
The cats on this show. Don't worry, it's a cat show. It was 3 hours, as you know. That's a lot of programming. You've done this.
I was just going to say you could pronounce my name. Most people pronounce it Dave Gehry.
Gehry, I can kind of get the phonetics on that one. That one sounds easy. So basically, Dave, I've not heard much. I have not, but we've been doing this a long time. Don't fault me for that. That's why you come on to shows like this, because if I'm in that situation, so are other people, quite frankly. So, you know, it's always getting our word out. So I don't know a whole lot about your work, but I do understand that you are an author. You wrote a book with a Mr. Philip Tierney called Erasing the Liberty, what you call the battle to keep alive the memory of Israel's massacre on the USS Liberty. But talking to you privately, David, you've got an impressive history about the USS Liberty, and perhaps you are one of the most knowledgeable men now on this planet about the USS Liberty. And that came through a lot of hard work and just good old journalism, talking to a lot of people. How many people have you interviewed on that were a part or a crew on the USS Liberty?
Yeah, probably I would say about maybe close to 50, which is a big number. I'm one of these types, you know, that term analysis is paralysis, right? Well, I like to go as far as I can, and it actually, in this case, paid off because I uncovered a lot of heretofore unknown information about the Liberty that helps to paint a better picture of what happened during that attack, or as I began to call it last year in the spring, massacre, because that's exactly what it was. The casualty rate was over 71%, and it was probably a lot higher because a lot of these folks I found out never applied for benefits for being injured. So many of them, their dads were in World War II or Korea, mostly World War II, and they didn't feel like they deserved to get recognized for their injuries. So I did interview a few people who were injured and who never brought that to the attention of the ship or the people who would record that so they could get the Purple Heart Award, which is awarded to people who were wounded in combat from the enemy. So the 208 Purple Heart Awards that were given out to the crew of the Liberty were given to them explicitly against the enemy. So what they were saying was that Israel was the enemy, even though they would never openly say it.
Again, let's take it back a step now, because not everybody knows the story. It's one of, like you say, you're trying to keep alive the memory of this thing. And a lot of people don't even know about it to have it kept alive. Describe what was the USS Liberty and the conditions upon which it was actually attacked by the Israelis.
Yes, yeah, sure. Well, the USS Liberty was a converted World War II cargo ship. So it ran cargo and troops from primarily the West Coast to the Pacific theaters of war. And what happened was that it was getting ready to just be scrapped, and the National Security Agency, the NSA, came up with the idea that why don't we take some of these unarmed and unarmored cargo ships and turn them into seaborne listening platforms. So they took a bunch of these ships, I think about five of them, and they converted them into exactly what I said. And the crew complement was about 300, and about 100 were what's called ship's company. And basically, those are the sailors who make the ship run. And the other 200 were spies. They were primarily what are known as CTs, or what were known as CTs, communications technicians. Now they changed that to cryptographic technicians, I believe is the term right now. And there are various groups of these CTs, different what they call sub-ratings. So some of these CTs repair the equipment, some of them are in operation, some of them are linguists. And so they commissioned these five ships that were based on what was called the Victory Hull. They were Victory Hull ships. And they sent them around the globe, and what they would do was just simply go close to the coastline of whatever countries they were monitoring and pick up the electronic signals. So the Liberty itself had 45 antennae on it to help it do that, and one of the antennae was called a moon relay. And what that would do was when the Liberty was able to see the moon, and it was also in the sight of the National Security Agency, they could bounce signals off the moon to get to the NSA. So it was a pretty sophisticated piece of equipment. The Liberty was known as the most sophisticated seaborne listening platform at the time. And their station was Africa, the west coast of Africa. So they had, for example, Russian linguists, Portuguese linguists, and other languages that might be applicable to the colonial powers or powers that are were up and coming at that time. And this is in the early 60s, of course. And this was in May of 1967 when there was word of a possible clash in the Mideast between Israel and the surrounding Arab countries. What we call Egypt today was known as the United Arab Republic, and Syria and Jordan. And of course, at the time, and even now, Israel wasn't an ally, technically, of the United States. They never signed a mutual defense pact or mutual defense treaty with the United States.
To this day, there's no treaties between us. There's memorandums of understanding, but there are no treaties that bind America to Israel to this day.
That's right.
Which is a good
point. The
United
States offered Israel the opportunity to have one after the almost disastrous 1973 so-called Yom Kippur War, but Israel turned it down for a variety of reasons, one being that they already had a full complement of spies in the United States, so they were able to find out the information that was necessary for them to find out. Two is that if you sign a mutual defense pact or treaty, it's based upon recognized borders, and Israel never really had clearly recognized borders, although some people say they do. And the other thing is that when you want to, for example, go into Lebanon and massacre a couple of thousand civilians, you would have to let your ally know that this was your plan, that you were going to go into Gaza or Lebanon and ruin a bunch of people's lives. And they didn't want to have any part of that. So although they weren't technically allies, there was a connection which began through their intelligence services to combat communism around the world. So the CIA and the what's called the Mossad, that's their intelligence, their national intelligence service, they had a relationship primarily through this character, Angleton, who cultivated that relationship with the Israelis. And so there was communication between the Israelis or Tel Aviv and Washington at the time regarding this particular matter that was unfolding in the Mideast, which took the form of what they call, one of the terms for it is the Six-Day War. And the issue.
You gotta get that six in there, Dave. You got to get that
six. Probably. And the issue stemmed from primarily the nationalist leader of the United Arab Republic, Egypt, Nasser, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was a very charismatic and very populist leader. And of course, as we can see with what's happening with Trump, they don't like that. The powers that be, or as many people rightfully say, the powers that should not be, don't like that. And so they were after him. The United States hated him. Even the Soviet Union thought that it would be best, even though that was a client state of theirs, they thought that it would be best that he would go away. And in fact, Kennedy, and that was one of the reasons they blew his head off in broad daylight, Kennedy wanted to have warmer relations with Egypt, which they were actually planning on meeting shortly after they blew his head off in broad daylight. But it never happened, and Nasser was in an uncomfortable position politically, and he ended up closing this Straits of Tehran, which really Israel wasn't impacted, but maybe a few percent, 5% at most of its commercial shipping, but they wanted to make a statement. So via their spies across the region in Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, those with due loyalty who were living in the host countries but had their ultimate allegiance to Israel, they assisted, obviously, Israel. Over the years, this war was planned much, much earlier.
Yes.
And it was preemptive. And Israel basically wiped out the Egyptian Air Force in about an hour and a half.
Another way of saying unprovoked.
What's that?
I said preemptive is another way to say an unprovoked.
Yes,
exactly. A schoolyard sucker punching, kind of like what do you call that nowadays in America, where you got the blacks going around and just smacking the white guys?
That's the knockout game.
Yeah, the knockout game. This is basically a geopolitical knockout game. Same type of ethics, same type of character.
That's correct, 100% correct. And they did this, and what happened was that, and by the way, let me just tell you a brief background story about this because it's pretty fascinating. This one particularly prolific Jewish spy named Eli Cohen. He had befriended many of the Egyptian military and feigned that he was interested in their welfare because they were out there in the desert and there was no shade. And he said, please let me plant some trees here for you so you can rest under the trees and get some shade because you're sitting out here and the sun's beating down on you. What he did that for was they were markers. They were targeting markers. And so it was easy for Israel to do what they did. It wasn't the brilliant victory that is painted in our history books, but what it was duplicitous.
This was basically cowards.
What's that?
These were cowards essentially planning out how they're going to play the knockout game.
Yeah, exactly. They're sneaky, conniving cowards. That's right, because they have to rely on that in order to get done what they want to get done. So, anyway, Eli Cohen was caught, and he was hung in the public square, I believe, it might have been in Damascus. It was in Syria. So this led to their smashing success. And, of course, they were coming back and forth to Washington to get permission to do this. And Johnson, who was surrounded by the probably, up to this point, biggest Zionist contingent of advisors of any president, and Johnson himself was half Jewish on his mother's side, which isn't really promoted in the garbage, which what I call the garbage media, mainstream media, because it belongs in the garbage. And Johnson didn't want to do that. He didn't want to allow them to do that because at the time, obviously, there was Vietnam, there was the Cold War. There was the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union's involvement in that region. So they accelerated the schedule, Israel did, and they launched their preemptive attack about almost a week before they said that they were going to do it. And prior to that, at the end of May, of course, the Soviet Union was aware of what was going on, and they were talking to Washington to have Israel back off. They said, look, if you have Israel back off here, then we'll back off in Vietnam. And Washington applied pressure on the Israelis, and they thought that they would do that, and so did the Soviet Union. And so the Soviet Union actually did pull their Viet Cong troops back somewhat, and it wasn't reported in the garbage media, of course, but that was actually an effect of this behind the scenes backdoor discussion. So intelligence showed that if there was a clash there, that Israel would be victorious. And so what happened was that the Liberty, at the end of May, they were moved from their station off the west coast of Africa to the eastern Mediterranean via Rota, Spain, which is still a Navy base there in Spain. And they stopped off in Rota. They dropped off some linguists. They picked up six more linguists, three Marines and three civilians. And then they steamed down to the, at that time, the Egyptian-controlled Gaza Strip. And they just went into like a little oval, doing maybe 8 knots and just trying to pick up whatever they could. They didn't have any.
How far offshore were they from the Israeli border of the Gaza shoreline?
Yeah, so they were in international waters about 14 miles off the coast. They were about 45 miles southwest of Tel Aviv. They weren't there to monitor the Israelis. In fact, they were prohibited from monitoring two countries' communications, the UK and Israel. Mm-hmm. And I believe that
the treason goes way back there, David.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because they have infiltrated our once great nation so wonderfully that they were able to convince the military and intelligence bureaucracy not to monitor them. So there were no Hebrew linguists on there. They were trying to pick up.
I was going to ask you that one.
Yeah,
I was going to ask that. So
yeah,
there were none.
Okay. Yes, there were none.
Yeah,
although
I was going to ask that.
What's that?
You're going to ask, yeah, because I'm like, okay, you're going next to Israel. How many Hebrew guys were there? Okay, zero. We got that one out of the way.
Zero. Yes, that's right. And although there's a lot of mythology around the Liberty story, and that's a part of it, too, that people want to believe that there were Hebrew linguists there, but there were not. So what happened was that they get there and they're trying to pick up signals because the potential existed of a serious conflict there between the superpowers because of our friends Israel. So the United States didn't have any real control over them. And the last time that happened was with Eisenhower, who forced them to back off during that Suez crisis, Israel, the UK, and France. They went after Egypt again, same story. This is basically Suez 2. So Kennedy obviously didn't really like these people, and he said, or what they were doing, you know, he said that, you know, we need to monitor your nuclear facility, Dimona. And a lot of people believe that Israel had a lot to do with his murder, that again, they were involved in like 9/11, like you name it, that they were involved in the murder of JFK because he was actively opposing them acquiring nuclear weapons. So what happened was that they were trying to pick up the signals from the Arabs or Arab linguists on board, because I interviewed several of them, and there were Russian linguists on board. And they wanted to pick up what was going on so they would be apprised of it. They could get, like I said, they could get this information immediately to Washington and the NSA, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the NSA. And so on the morning of June 8th, and the war had started on June 5th. That's when they launched that preemptive sneak attack on June 5th. And it was almost done. It was almost complete. They were mopping up. So a lot of people say, geez, why would Israel attack the Liberty? It doesn't make sense because the war was complete. Well, it wasn't complete because they hadn't yet gone into the Golan Heights. So, and that's what they're still holding it. They're illegally holding it. They're not supposed to be holding it, but it's got a lot of oil and it's got a lot of strategic.
A lot of water,
exactly. And, you know, it's strategic aims are very necessary to this rogue regime in Israel or this rogue country. And so what happened was that the Soviet Union knew that they would be doing that, and they were making motions to actually meet the Israelis on the ground if they tried to approach Damascus. So they got rights to fly into Yugoslavia from Tito, and they were actually planning on dropping paratroops in between Damascus and Israel. So we're talking, we were very close to this. And this type of reckless behavior by this rogue regime, by this rogue country, is nothing new. So, and this is what we know about. What don't we know about? That's the problem. So what happened was that the Liberty on the morning of June 8th was a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. The Mediterranean Sea was calm. The flag was fluttering. And approximately at 6 o'clock in the morning, overflights began by Israeli reconnaissance aircraft, primarily what were known as the Nor Atlas. So they were armed primarily by the French. The United States was not arming Israel at the time. They were rewarded after they murdered and massacred these boys on the Liberty with arms.
Yes. All right. Nick Fury is our guest right today. It's again August 11th. And so we'll be back with more right after this. All right, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Fetch Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware right here on Revolution Radio at revolution.radio, one of the largest listener sponsored and supported radio networks. And we appreciate you all coming on this fine Saturday. You can hear the moss going off in the background, everybody. Hopefully you can't hear it, but I can sure hear it. It's very loud, to say the least. Joining us for the second half of the third hour here, Mr. David Gaharie. I think I said that right. I hope I said that right. He is, again, the author of the book Erasing the Liberty, The Battle to Keep Alive, The Memory of Israel's Massacre on the USS Liberty. And, again, we're recounting really some of the history. We're going to get some of the future projects on this quickly. But, David, welcome back.
Thank you, Dennis. Yep, you said it right. At least, again, you know what? It's only a name. It doesn't matter much. What matters is what we learn and what we do and how we try to leave this place in better shape than when we came into it, I think. But where I was at was that the Liberty was being surveilled by Israeli planes, not jets, Israeli planes, although there are reports that there are some jets higher up. But I mean close enough that the boys on board the Liberty could see the pilots in these propeller planes, and they were waving to them. There were a bunch of pro-Israel...
Let's go back real quick. Let's go back quick. When you look at the ship, we've got a ship. It is filled with really some of the most elite people in our armed forces. That is the signals intelligence guys. These guys are very sharp guys, generally speaking. You don't get into that role unless you're smart. You've interviewed 50 of these people. How many of these 50 said that, hey, I saw these guys. We can almost see their eyes on these aircraft from the Israelis.
Every one of them who are, topside.
Okay, so half of basically everybody that was topside. How many waves of aircraft actually came in to attack the USS Liberty?
Well, the surveillance went from 0600 to about 1200. So they surveilled for about 6 hours. They knew that it was the USS. What's that?
This is being done by propeller aircraft, which are very slow observation type aircraft, correct?
Correct. That's right.
Okay. So they're cruising maybe 140 knots above. Everybody can easily see what's going on at that speed.
Absolutely. And they were equipped with cameras. So they were filming. They knew that it was the USS Liberty. Israel at Tel Aviv admitted it, that they had it plotted on one of their maps in their war room. And so they knew it was the Liberty.
We've got 6 hours now, 6 hours of observation.
That's right.
We don't have any signals intelligence coming from these aircraft because we're told not to listen.
That's true. So, right? Fortunately, the Navy and the ships weren't allowed to, but there was a Navy plane flying up above it, like 50,000 feet, an EC-121, which was monitoring. So they provided
the proof. Are the Israelis aware of this?
No, they are now, but they provided the proof that the Israelis knew all along that it was an American ship.
So 6 hours transpire. Right around noon, the first wave starts to come.
Happened was they stopped surveilling around noon, and then it was lunchtime. A lot of these guys were out when they're off watch. They were out sunning on the decks and whatever else they were doing, smoking and having a good time and having lunch. And then right after lunch, they had a general quarters drill, a chemical attack drill. They were drilling constantly because they were in a war zone and they never knew what would happen. And that's what you do in the Navy anyway. So they were drilling, and then the drill ended, and almost exactly at 1400 hours at 2 o'clock was when out of the sun came these Israeli Mirage jets, French again, because the U.S. wasn't supplying arms to these people. And again, a completely unprovoked attack. People are sunbathing, and they were rooting for Israel. Many of the sailors, they actually had made little Israeli flags aboard the ship because they knew a little bit about what was happening, and they were rooting for the Israelis because they were their friends. And so the assault from the Mirages lasted, let's say, about 10 minutes and they expended all of their ammo.
Okay, and a Mirage is going to fly. Okay, just real quick to keep everybody, a Mirage, it flies just a little under Mach 1, you know, 400-500 miles per hour.
Yeah, they're tough to see. And so that's why one of the things is that all of the people who witnessed these planes attacking the Liberty, all of them said they were unmarked. So
they were unmarked.
Unmarked. Yes. No one has said that they were marked.
Interesting.
So that's probably the way it unfolded. They were not marked. They were disguised. Again, duplicitousness. After the Mirages did their dirty work with their rockets and cannon fire and machine gun fire, then these Mysteers moved in. And they also pelted the Liberty.
What are these aircraft? What are these?
Well, these are slower bomber aircraft, and they were kind enough to drop napalm on the Liberty. And if you know anything about napalm, you know that it can create self-sustaining winds of over 700 miles an hour and basically suck the air.
David, you're breaking up.
What's that? Say again, Dennis.
Yeah, you are breaking up seriously there, and I'm noticing it could be on my side equally. I've got some notes coming up on my monitoring software that says we've had technical issues here with the internet. So
it happens. Basically,
yeah, of course, it's the internet. But it's doing this for 7 years. It's happened more than once, believe me. The aircraft you're talking about, these are basically slower turboprop bombers?
No, these are jets. These are jets as well, but they're not primarily attack aircraft. They're more fighter bombers. And so, as I said, they drop napalm on the ship, which, as I was saying, I don't know if you could hear me now or if I'm breaking up.
You're okay there. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What napalm does is the activation of napalm creates self-sustaining winds of over 700 miles an hour. And the heat is, I think, equal to that of what's on the temperature of the surface of the sun. And they literally suck the air out of the lungs of living things. So they asphyxiate. So these nice people, the Israelis, our great friends, did this, dropped the napalm on these boys. And after they expended all of their ammo, shortly thereafter...
Also, David, doesn't the napalm, besides the asphyxiation issue, it's also designed to essentially make sure that nobody can come up from underneath the ship and get to the top, get surface. Obviously, on a ship, if it's going to sink, you need to get to the surface as quickly as possible. And that napalm is blocking all the escape paths to get back out of the ship.
Yes, that's right. In fact, it was dripping. It was dripping down below decks. And another thing that it does, now that you brought that up, is that it has the ability to stick to skin and just
like
continue.
Phosphorus, it burns through you.
Yes, continue burning. So it's a very horrible thing and it was created here in this once great nation at one of the universities, I believe Harvard. And I think that that was one of the only. What's that?
After the napalm attack, this is a coordinated attack to just not have any survivors left. So we've napalmed it.
Absolutely.
We've attacked it. We've rocketed it. We've hit cannons with it, which is basically 20 millimeter shells.
20,
something
30,
like that.
And 40, yep.
Okay, there you go. And then now we've napalmed it. What comes next?
Well, what comes next is that, obviously, it's mayhem on board. And they murdered... Nine boys and men. And
at this stage, we've lost
at this stage, although perhaps one or two of them had not passed on yet. They were below decks. They turned the mess decks into a hospital, into a sick bay. And all of a sudden, three images were picked up on radar. There were three motor torpedo boats, again, French-made, wood-hulled motor torpedo boats equipped with German-made torpedoes that were converted from the type of torpedoes that they used to drop from seaplanes. And they were coming in attack formation, and Ultimately, they launched all of their torpedoes separately.
And how many is all?
What's that?
How many is all?
Five. So each one could hold two, but five got off, four missed, one hit, sadly. And that one that hit blew about a 40-foot hole amidships on the starboard, which is the left side, and murdered instantly 25 communications technicians. Boys. Young boys. Now, they continued to, after they did that, continued to rake the Liberty with their machine gun and cannon fire. They were shooting at stretcher bearers, sailors trying to put out fires. They also were shooting at the life rafts, especially the last three life rafts that were thrown overboard to try to rescue whoever they could. They shot those life rafts in the water, which is a war crime. Now, I didn't mention that when the planes were attacking, they were also jamming all of the frequencies, not just the tactical frequencies, but the maritime distress signal frequencies. So they knew exactly what the frequencies were because they knew that it was the Liberty. They most likely got these frequencies from a American Jewish spy in D.C. And shortly after the air attack began, the Liberty was able to get off some SOS messages. Their code name was Rockstar. So any station, this net, this is Rockstar. We are under attack from unidentified aircraft. Any station, this net, please send help. This went on for a while. As I found out from my interviews, the fellow who really picked up this signal, although it was picked up by a variety of sources, but it was because it was being jammed and there was this buzzsaw signal that was created, so they couldn't get any SOSs out. What happened was that it was picked up by this radio operator on the USS Saratoga, one of the aircraft carriers that was taking part in some war games off the coast of Crete.
Saratoga, and, you're at a pre, this is World War II, the Saratoga from World War II. Is that the same operational?
No, that's a different one.
It's a later Saratoga.
Yes, okay. As well as the America. And what happened was that the Saratoga and the America both launched sorties of jets and propeller planes to come to the aid of the Liberty, naturally. Well, because at the same time that this Liberty matter unfolded and this six-day war was unfolding, as is common now that we know, the U.S. military were conducting war games in the area. So a lot of their planes were equipped with nuclear weapons. They were nuclear armed. So when they launched the first sortie to go out and help the Liberty, it was called back. At the time, the skipper of the America was thinking that, and the Saratoga, that maybe some imbecile in D.C., some guy who doesn't know any better, made a mistake. So they launched another they scrambled another bunch of jets, and this one was recalled by none other than the Secretary of Defense, Robert Strange McNamara. And the order was challenged by the Rear Admiral, who was in charge of the Carrier Task Force. And the next person who came on the line was LBJ, who basically told the guy to get those planes back, or you're going to be pushing pencils. I will not embarrass an ally over a few dead sailors. So because the top
and you know what? I know we discussed this, David, but I just don't understand why when you have your own people being attacked, you don't accept be pushing a pencil for a while. I know it's the military and you follow orders, but I'll tell you what, man. This is, to me, is just treason to not go help people.
Absolutely. Without a doubt. This fella actually told the story to the head of research department, the spies on board the Liberty, and he asked him never to reveal it until after he died, which he waited 20 years. And then after he died, he told the story about Johnson doing this. And this was corroborated by another person that I interviewed who had lunch with the skipper of the America. So, and of course, the skipper of the Saratoga, Joe Tully, he passed on, sadly, but he was still confused up till his dying day about why they recalled the jets. So they let the Liberty languish there with over 5,000 armor-piercing holes in it and over 850 cannon and rocket holes, some the size of basketballs. They let it languish for about 16 hours before they actually got help to the Liberty. The cover-up began immediately, primarily from Jewish American congressmen and senators, and of course, ultimately by the half-Jewish President LBJ. He covered it up completely. It's still covered up to this day. So when I found out about it, and this was even before I did the research to speak the way that I'm speaking, I realized that, and as a Navy man myself, I'm not going to allow this to happen. I'm going to do whatever I can in my power to expose what these people have done to my shipmates. And what they've done is they've brought dishonor and disgrace by not allowing this story to be told, by equating it with anti-Semitism. That's how they shut them up. And so I made a commitment to them and to the Navy and to the country, and because we have a lot of supporters from all over the world, and to anyone else who's interested in this, that no matter what, I will never, ever abandon these guys like they were abandoned. And we put out this book, Phil Turney and I, Erasing the Liberty. You can go to erasingtheliberty.com and get it. And we're planning a movie, a full-length feature film movie. You can go to usslibertymovie.com and look at the trailer that we filmed aboard a Victory-hulled ship in Tampa. And at this point, I can't release very good news about the movie, but things are moving in the right direction. And they don't want this movie out because, obviously, when you're sitting in the theater and you see a true story coming across the screen, you see this vicious massacre that took place, how they did it, and you see the reaction of our own government, the U.S. government, how they covered it up and continue to cover it up. And then the worst part of it is, you find out that the USS Liberty is the highest decorated ship in the history of the United States Navy for a single action, and no one knows about it. Every American school child should be learning about the Liberty, but these primarily American and international Jews don't want you to know about the Liberty. And the reason they don't is because it's going to make Israel look bad, and then it will make them look bad, but they don't mind disgracing and destroying the memory of these guys who had to put up with this massacre, who did nothing to Israel, who sat there as cannon fodder.
Yeah. You know, you've had an interesting thing. When you talk about a feature film, you're actually talking about putting together even this entire battle scene, and you've actually located some of these ships that are still available. Maybe we shouldn't talk about that because maybe they'll buy them up and scrap them, but these ships are somewhat available. We actually are able to actually recreate this pretty darn well if we can raise the money to make this thing happen.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And there's three of them left in the country. Yes, there's two in California and one in Florida. However, it's not necessary that's done. We took thousands of photographs on board this vessel in Tampa. We can recreate it using CGI. And we could build a set. That's not the issue. But yes, the point here being is we know who controls Hollywood. They even admit it. We know who controls the television networks. They admit it. We know who controls cable. We know who controls the big publishing houses. They've had 51 years to tell the story about the most decorated ship in the history of the United States Navy for a single action. But every year we get a movie on the Holocaust and Nazis. If they're not going to do it, we're going to do it. And guess what? It's probably not going to have a happy ending. The way that scripts are written, as I'm sure you know, is that they're written in three parts and it's supposed to end happily so people feel good leaving the movie theaters. Well, this isn't a happy ending and it's not going to be happy. And they're going to see the battle scene, the way it unfolded, which is horrendous, and they're going to see what their own government did. The only way we're going to get it done at this point is if folks go to erasingliberty.com and buy the book, which will help support the flick. And after they read the book, go to usslibertymovie.com and make a donation. Of course, they could donate beforehand, but a lot of folks read the book and then they learn what I was able to glean, and they understand the significance of the story. I don't know if you can hear me, Dennis, but or if I was just talking to myself, I don't know. But I can't hear you, my friend. Well, if anybody can hear me, I'll keep talking until I'm interrupted, because I can't hear anything from Dennis's end. USSLibertyMovie.com will have the trailer. There's like a trailer we made on this vessel in Tampa. It's a donation trailer with Liberty survivors in the trailer. And you could watch that. You can see what other events are coming up. We're going to be in San Antonio on September 8th for a conference. Phil and I with a bunch of other people, including Christopher Bolin. That is right on the Riverwalk in downtown San Antonio, just a few blocks away from the Alamo. You could find that on usslibertymovie.com. If you click on the events tab, and of course, erasingliberty.com is where you could get the book. And we send the books out right away. We ship all over the world. As I said earlier, we have a lot of supporters around the world. I think about 25% of our supporters are non-US. So a lot of Australians, a lot of UK, they want to see this story done.
How many speaking engagements do you do a year?
Well, it depends on the year. I mean, last year we had quite a few. We were in Texas. We were in Dallas. We spoke in front of the Military Order of the Purple Heart, which is obviously a military organization with members who have the Purple Heart Award for being wounded in combat by the enemy. And that was in front of about 400 people. That was the first time, believe it or not, after 50 years. That was August 16th of last year. That was the first time in 50 years that the USS Liberty story was allowed to get out to such a mainstream audience. This is how well the enemy is at suppressing this story and how intent they are on making sure that it stays under wraps. So we were in Dallas, we were in Albuquerque, we were in Denver, we were in Wyoming, we were in Pennsylvania, we were in Minnesota. So we travel around quite a bit to bring this to people who, as I said, most people don't really understand. Once they hear the story and once they know the story, especially after they read the book, they're very affected by it.
Calling from Canada, Vera, hi. Welcome to Inside the Eye Live with David Guerrero.
Hi, I just want to say a couple words. I want to thank him very much for doing this. And the more people that understand that these creepy guys are working against all of us, the sooner the better.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
By the way, we could hear the talker throughout it all. It's you, Fetch, that kind of cut in and out.
Yeah, I suspect that's the girls playing with the YouTube out front and killing my bandwidth. Oh. I forgot about telling them and warning them.
Oh.
So I think the girl.
Okay, anyways, excellent show. I really appreciate it. And I'll let you go, okay, and finish your story.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate the call. And this is, as I said, this is really, because there is a lot of mythology about the Liberty out there. You know, like the story about Johnson saying, I want that goddamn ship down at the bottom of the sea. He never said that, but a lot of people want to believe that. A lot of people believe that it was a false flag. They wanted to blame it on Egypt because they wanted it sunk and everybody dead. And by the way, helicopters showed up after the motor torpedo boats with commandos on board to finish the job. But they took off because the jig was up. But even if the facts are just shown, specifically if the facts are just shown, undisputed facts that no one disagrees with, that's enough to really have a great impact. And this film will be a game changer for a lot of reasons.
And how long have you been promoting this now? 2 years now?
Phil contacted me when I was moving from New Jersey to Florida in August of 2015 to start working on something. He didn't quite know what it was, but he had met me and we had spoke a couple of times and he liked me. And Phil was the Liberty survivor who was with the ship years before the massacre, and he took it back home to the United States. So he knows, he was in damage control, so he knows a lot about the Liberty.
How many survivors still are living today?
Don't know for sure, but there were 294 aboard. They murdered 34. They wounded about 175 or more. And I would say that out of the crew of about 300, there's probably about half still alive. I know that since we started the project in August 2015, we've lost 4 Liberty survivors, and I interviewed 3 of those survivors.
And have you ever put the word out that you'd like to talk to every single one?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's what I was saying, is that you would think that after all this time, they would have come forward. But just 2 weeks ago, I interviewed 2 more people who were not on board the Liberty, but they were on board other ships who came to the aid of the Liberty. So they're still out there.
Very cool. We're actually out of time. That picked up quicker than we thought. We're out of time now. Thanks for coming on. It's The Fetch, everybody. See you Thursday inside the ILI prime time. See ya. Have a good day.
Thanks,
have a good
week. Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Thanks, David.